You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Patrick Hiller. Patrick Hiller is the executive director of the War Prevention Initiative by the Jubitz Family Foundation and teaches in the Conflict Resolution Program at Portland State University. As a peace scientist, his writings and research are related to the analysis of war and peace and social injustice. Among other involvements, Patrick serves on the executive committee of the Governing Council of the International Peace Research Association and on the Coordinating Committee of World Beyond War, where he works with me at worldbeyondwar.org. Patrick Hiller, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me, David.
It's great. I don't know why you haven't been on here earlier. We'll have to have you again. The War Prevention Initiative has just created a new publication called the Peace Science Digest. And the first issue, I have to say, is wonderful. And I want to talk about a number of the articles in it. But first, what is peace science? What is that about?
That's the good question, one that I keep on getting, so I'd love to address that. I think in its shortest form, peace science is really the research and theory needed to guide peace workers to produce more enduring and positive peace. So, I mean, now we're looking really as an academic discipline. We have our graduate programs. There are more than 450 on the world now. There are handbooks, research tools, theories, associations, journals, and conferences. So I'll use my own example. I earned a doctorate degree in conflict analysis and resolution. So now I teach that at Portland State, where there's a master's program in conflict resolution. As you mentioned, I'm on the executive committee of a peace research association. I don't know how many people even know that there is such an organization. And we have conferences, we network, we have our journals. So in my own teaching and research, I can resort to material like the Handbook of Conflict Resolution or the Handbook of Peace and Conflict Studies. The point is, peace science is real, and I think it's here to stay.
And to some extent, it is a science in that you do studies and surveys and investigations and try to establish what works and what doesn't through experience, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can also say it simply, in our field, we study the causes of war and the conditions for peace, and we use scientific methodology that is quantitative and qualitative science. And what I think is quite unique about our field is really that it has that goal of actually contributing toward peace. And that's something I really want to remind my fellow peace researchers and those beyond. And if I, yeah.
Do the researchers sometimes forget the sort of activist goal of trying to increase peace?
Unfortunately, in fact, they do. And it is really, I mean, I know many since I'm involved in so many associations there. And I think it's not the fact that they are not with us peace advocates in that regard, but they're still caught in the kind of in the paradigm of how to conduct science, that whole notion of always being neutral. I'm just in the middle of examining our own field. I reviewed more than 200 articles right now from peer-reviewed peace research articles that looked at terrorism or terrorists or terror since September 11th, 2001. And very, very few actually in their solutions address the notion of getting rid of the military option to address terrorism. And I think that is somewhat of a failure in our field.
One would think that a field of peace science wouldn't have a war option anywhere in it.
I would assume that too, and this is something that I'm committed to in my own work, and where I also very publicly try to get our field of peace researchers to be more active and more clear. I think it's not very useful if we come up with good, there is tremendously good research, but I think we also need to combine that with really saying this is the alternative to military option and not putting it into a context where military options are still part of it.
Yeah, well, I, as you know, I met not long ago with the director of the U.S. Institute of Peace, and she told me that the way to peace was sometimes through war, which would explain why that institute promotes wars. I guess the lesson is to find out if the peace studies program and the peace science you're learning from and reading is actually advocating peace or not. Is that part of why? I mean, I sort of wanted to ask you why create a new journal. Presumably, there are a number of journals out there. You just read 200 articles out of them. Why create the Peace Science Digest?
Well, let me explain kind of our thinking how we got to that. I mean, I will put out the basic assumption that peace science matters. There is really good, solid research coming out of it. But at the same time, and I'm going to take away that part about the kind of the neutrality there. I'm just going to say there are really meaningful results. But as with most scientific communities, there is kind of the challenge of transferring that academic knowledge into practical application. And within our own field of peace science, I have to be very blunt. If the knowledge of peace science gets stuck within academia, it's useless. So given the nature of academic publishing, so in particular we have academic research and journals, we are looking at three obstacles. Work is not accessible, it's not very understandable, and thereby not very useful. So let me explain. It's not very accessible because it is in peer-reviewed journals that are only available in university databases. Or you can buy articles or entire journals at very high costs as an individual. And it's not understandable because that's the nature of academic writing, in particular when it comes to looking at research of results of quantitative studies. Or, like, let's say, really solid statistical data. So, therefore, it's not very useful because we need, in academic publishing, there's not much space for really going into the practical suggestions of what does this actually mean other than a few lines in the conclusion. And so I just want to be clear, the researchers here are not the ones to fault because this is simply the way they have to write and present their material to get published. But with this Peace Science Digest, we are looking at a way to get beyond those limitations of academic journal publishing, especially in the field where I said where we need to inform practice on how to bring about peace.
We're speaking with Patrick Hiller, Executive Director of the War Prevention Initiative. You can go to warpreventioninitiative.org and find Peace Science Digest. And Patrick, my impression from the first issue is that you have succeeded wonderfully because these are very clear, short summaries of scientific studies and surveys, and then they're followed by recommendations or how to make use of this information. Maybe we could go to the first article in the first issue and talk about the topic there, which is a study that claims to have proven that public support for wars goes down significantly in a couple of cases. One is when the existence of alternatives to wars is made known. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. It shows to me that we were successful. But that's exactly how we were trying to get that information out. And now just think about the actual title of this, just the title alone of this article, which is called Norms, Diplomatic Alternatives, and the Social Psychology of War Support.
That's not the article in your digest. That's the article you're drawing from.
Exactly, yeah. But the point is the original article, the peer-reviewed article, is already, the title alone is already not as useful as what we're trying to do in our digest here. And as you said, there's something really important in that article. That is, when the public is made aware of diplomatic alternatives, there is a decline in support for war. And we don't get that if we look at our current national conversation. It always seems that, well, war is the last support and we've exhausted all other options.
And how did they prove this, that people prefer alternatives or less supportive of war if they know there are alternatives? How did they establish that?
That is when they had a group of participants, and we very briefly addressed that in the article, because we do want to go away from kind of going too much into the methodology and kind of the nuts and bolts of the science there to come to the result.
Yeah.
But they essentially looked at groups and gave them different options, different scenarios, where they measured the levels of support based on whether they were made aware of diplomatic or other nonviolent alternatives or not. And within those, they got to those results. And one of the reasons why we are trying to get away from the nuts and bolts of the research is because our point of departure is that this is a peer-reviewed article, and it is already been scrutinized to be published in one of the top journals in the field. So we don't want to spend too much time on that, but really go to what's in there and what does it mean.
Well, I think you're probably absolutely right in that approach. I just think that, I mean, it's interesting to me, at least, and maybe to some of our listeners, that when they asked people, would you support this war, and there are no alternatives, they got strong support. When they asked people, would you support this war, but here are some alternatives, they got low support. And when they asked people, will you support this war, and didn't say anything, there are alternatives, there aren't alternatives, just silence, well, then they got the same level of support as if they had said there are no alternatives. So that their conclusion was, if I understand correctly, that people are just assuming that there are no alternatives if they aren't mentioned, that their good government officials have done the same as they or their friends would do and tried everything else but war first, and presented war only because it was a last resort. Why, given our government's records, anyone would make that assumption is beyond me. But it's interesting that seems to be the assumption being made, that politicians are decent people.
Absolutely. And that's why I think with this, highlighting this research and using that in our work as peace advocates, I think we really need to be out there singing it from all the rooftops that we have all those alternatives, because this is how we actually can decrease the public support for war. And this is actually a particular area that I work on in my organization at the War Prevention Initiative. When it comes to ISIS, Syria, the Iran nuclear deal, we did very solid work on providing nonviolent alternative responses to the well-known military options that are out there. And we did that based on insights from peace science. And I'd like to say, to a certain extent, we were successful in different areas. But I think this is just the beginning of kind of paths that peace advocates can engage in.
I agree that you have been on that and doing great work on that, and it's very much in demand. Everyone wants to know if you don't bomb ISIS, what is it that you would do instead? There's a huge demand for that, and you can show it to people, and they can refuse to understand it and go on demanding it. But I think it's very, very useful, and there, of course, has been some success, at least on the Iran agreement. What about past wars that have already been started in years and decades gone by, and showing people that there were specific alternatives to those particular wars? Is there reason to believe that could be helpful if we were able to make people aware of those alternatives?
Well, absolutely. I think that's also work that you have been doing very well, and that we're integrating in our common work at World Beyond Wars, is looking at the whole mythology around war, because many of the past wars are really based on a series, and our understanding of them based on a series of myths. So I would certainly integrate that and make it clear not everything has to be peace science. We don't see that this our peace science perspective and the digest is the one answer to all. We think it's a contribution and a needed one, in a broader framework of understanding those matters and working towards ending war.
The other finding, if I understood correctly in this first article, was that if the politicians are not unanimous in their support for war, then the public is less supportive or tolerant of the war. I mean, does that suggest that, you know, Barbara Lee alone voting against the war back in 2001 made a significant difference, or a handful of politicians speaking up could make a significant difference in terms of public support for a war?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that there is an opportunity to almost drive a wedge into the political landscape by moving beyond that consensus that of war support in Washington, D.C. I think numbers matter there. So I think it's a matter of moving forward person by person when we look at our lawmakers.
The second article in this first issue, which is full of incredibly useful information, opens up a lot of questions for me. Can you describe the basic finding about how quality of life and the tolerance in a society impacts a society's willingness to go to war or to allow a war?
Yeah, that's a good one and somewhat tricky one. So I still have my questions around that. But essentially, this study looks at how quality of life impacts individuals' willingness to take up arms. So this study finds that when people experience higher life opportunity, they become less willing to give their life in service to their country's wars. So life opportunities here, for example, are education, income, life expectancy, or living conditions. So let me look at this maybe in a meaningful practical way. We have ISIS. So what is sold to our public is that there's a homogeneous group of violent religious extremists. Well, they're not that homogeneous. In fact, most of the fighters are young men with no life opportunities. So just imagine if the focus here is on education, jobs, improving living conditions, then we are taking away one of the primary recruiting tools for the fighters. Obviously, another one is the military engagement in the Middle East, primarily by the U.S., which is probably the primary recruitment tool there.
Now, were there two arguments in this case that the quality of your life, prosperity, security, and so forth is one thing that makes you less likely to support war or going to war, and the other is the level of social tolerance in your society, gender equality, sexual liberation, and so forth?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I personally think the importance in this study lies and looking at the life opportunities, the way I just described it.
Yeah.
But the the point about socially tolerant values has to do that when within a society pro-choice values rise, the willingness to sacrifice declines, essentially. But again, I can draw more out of the life opportunities in terms of what it means to advance the work of peace advocates.
Yeah. I mean, it makes a certain logical sense that on the one hand, we're talking about the value of someone's own life, and so they become less willing to go and sacrifice their life. And on the other hand, we're talking about people's ability to value the lives of others who are different from them, which could decrease their willingness to support the bombing of foreigners. It makes a certain sense that both of those could be right. The authors suggest this, or at least the first part of that, as an explanation for the lack of wars between the rich countries since World War II. It seems to me there may be a combination of explanations in the existence of nuclear weapons, the establishment of laws, cultural turns against war. I think clearly not the existence of democracies, which you actually have another article about in issue one. But, is this really a new explanation for why the big rich countries haven't gone to war?
Well, I don't know if it's a new explanation in that regard. I think, and I'd also add, we don't always need new explanation. We sometimes need commonly believed and held assumptions proven by some of the research that is out there.
But I don't hold it. It seems wrong to me. I mean, it seems like the United States is very well off, very wealthy, at least relative to much of the world, at least for some people here, and is war crazy. And Europe is roughly as well off, better quality of life in some ways, and is more war averse. It seems there must be other factors at work.
Right. And I mean, that is the beauty of research like that, and I would always, I always emphasize when we have those findings, I would explain it in a way that what we found here contributes to, can be a contributing factor to, instead of kind of putting it out there is a sole explanation for, and that leaves the space that we need for other factors and explanations that we have to certainly examine in our own country, why we are so keen on fighting war after war after war.
Yeah, that seems right to me, and it seems like there is a connection between intolerance domestically and support for wars. And that, too, seems to make sense in terms of the United States as an outlier. I mean, there was a Gallup poll last year in which 44% of people in the United States claimed they would go to war for their country. And of course, thankfully, they are not all going to recruitment stations and signing up. But that compared to 18% in Germany, 15% in the Netherlands, 10% in Japan, or going the other way, 66% in Israel. There doesn't seem to be one simple factor that could be making those differences.
Right, and I fully agree, and that's where we have to continue to explore all the factors and see how we can manage them and intervene and transform them, if we are interested in doing what you and I and millions of others are doing, that is creating a world beyond war.
Yeah, and it's wonderful that these articles conclude with recommendations for what to do, because it seems like in many cases this information could be twisted different ways. Right? I mean, the United States claimed that, you know, Vietnamese society was intolerant and didn't value its lives, and if they valued their lives, they would give up. And because they valued life cheaply, we should go ahead and kill more of them. And you know, it seems like if a tolerant society, if with Western values, is the way to peace, you know, that could be an argument for bringing tolerance and prosperity to poor countries, or it could be an argument for imposing Western control on poor countries for their own good, depending who's spinning the information.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, this was really also our, you mentioned it, how we actually have some recommendations, and we were very conscious about how we're structuring our digest, where we analyze each article on no more than 2 pages. And then for each article, we provide some thoughts on why is it relevant beyond academia, what are the key talking points, and then we offer some practical implications. And, I mean, I want to be very clear and also humble about this effort at this point. This is what we're looking at is what we call our pilot issue, and we've launched a survey together with the Peace Science Digest, and we're very interested in getting feedback on how this resonates with folks out there and how they can use it, because this is not an academic exercise for sure, and this should be a useful tool for those of us who are peace advocates.
How can people check it out and give you that feedback?
Well, we have it. It's free at our website, and you can get there through either communication.warpreventioninitiative.org, and there is an online viewer, and you can download it as a PDF. And we actually printed a few of them just to see how it looks, and they really look fantastic. And we have a link to the survey on the homepage, and we'd be happy to have feedback. And I will talk to anyone who wants to call or email me and chat about that. And my email address is philler@pdx.edu.
So go to warpreventioninitiative.org or go to communication.warpreventioninitiative.org. Really quickly, Patrick, there's another article that I think confirms with hard facts and data something that many of us have always suspected, that where you report that third-party intervention is up to 100 times more likely when a country at war has large reserves of oil or the foreign intervener has a higher demand for oil. Not terribly shocking, but wonderful to have the data on, I would say.
Absolutely, and that might have been the single article that really drove us toward creating this Peace Science Digest. Because I'm actually one of the 7 people who read those articles, the actual journal articles.
Yeah.
And I could just not believe that something as meaningful as that is tucked away within the walls of academic publishing. And like you said, this is not surprising or shocking to hear that we're going to war for oil. But we can now back this assumption with strong evidence. And I think that you already summed it up, so I don't have to do that again.
Well, it's
but when oil, yeah.
We're running out of time, Patrick, but it's a wonderful service. There's a question debated in the public forums and answered in an obscure journal, and you're making the answer available to people. It's terrific. People should go to communication.warpreventioninitiative.org. Patrick Hiller, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, for many, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan is a clear case of environmental racism, the disproportionate infliction of environmental harms on communities of color, from the spraying of toxic pesticides to the siting of polluting factories. The government has a responsibility to address these harms, but do they do it? And if not, why not? These are some of the questions engaged by the Center for Public Integrity's Environmental Justice Denied series. We'll speak with Center reporter Talia Buford. Also on the show, the labeling of genetically modified food is a hard-fought policy battle as Americans demand information about what they eat, and industry demands the ability to obscure that information. But recent evidence suggests we should also pay attention to the labeling of the experts media present on the question of GMOs. Carrie Gillum is a longtime food and agriculture journalist, now research director at the group U.S. Right to Know. We'll talk with her about conflicts of interest in the coverage of our food supply. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Corporate media often seem to bemoan low voter turnout in this country. At the same time, a substantial subset of media's election coverage involves pondering why people vote the way they do and coming up with condescending answers. For The New Yorker, this means running a piece that makes fun of Bernie Sanders supporters for being uncool. In a piece headlined, "Should Millennials Get Over Bernie Sanders?" Spoiler alert, the answer is yes. Alexandra Schwartz says Sanders' obsession with the financial catastrophe that cost many their homes and life savings is weirdly retro. Quote, "We voters under 30 have come of political age during the economic recovery under President Obama. When I graduated from college, unemployment was close to 10%. It's now at 5%. Sanders' attention to socioeconomic justice is stirring and necessary, but when his campaign tweets that it's high time we stopped bailing out Wall Street and started repairing Main Street, you have to wonder why his youngest supporters, so attuned to staleness in all things cultural, are letting him get away with political rhetoric that would have seemed old even in 2012. Close quote. It's absolutely fine to critique politicians' style or their appeal to young people, but facts insist on being what they are. And as Dean Baker notes on fair.org, the hard truth is that for the vast majority of the public, pressing economic worries are very much a now kind of thing. The unemployment rate is reasonably low, largely because millions of workers have dropped out of the workforce. And that's not just retirees. The employment rate for prime age workers is down 3% from its pre-recession level for workers of all levels of education. The percentage of people involuntarily working part-time and the duration of periods of unemployment are all still at recession levels. And critically, the shift from wages to profits hasn't reversed, and wages are more than 6% lower than they would be if that labor share had not changed. If concern about all of that is retro, well, everything old is new again. At the New York Times, the post-Iowa chin-stroking took the form of columnist David Brooks' suggestion that since Donald Trump's campaign was based on the notion that success breeds success, his unimpressive finish in Iowa might cause his support to evaporate. Brooks mocks Trump supporters as reality TV watchers, interested only in sticking their thumb in somebody's eye. And he suggests that their resentments are really just a chip on the shoulder. Quote, "Social inequality is always felt more acutely than economic inequality. Trump rose up on behalf of people who felt looked down upon. made them feel vindicated, and turned social conduct on its head, close quote. Well, but who are Trump's people? Real Clear Politics provided a sketch based on polling that indicated Trump supporters are a bit older, less educated, and earn less than the average Republican. Slightly over half are women. About half are between 45 and 64, with another 34% over 65, less than 2% younger than 30. One half of his voters have a high school education or less. Well, middle-aged white people without college degrees are the demographic we've recently learned are seeing increasing death rates, due largely to increases in suicide, opiate overdoses, and cirrhosis. Lower-income people without degrees have also been on the raw end of the U.S. economy for decades now. It's not at all to say that the Trump phenomenon is benign, far from it. But for elite pundits to suggest that Trump supporters don't have real problems is probably not the best way to make sense of it. Finally, big media had some interest when The Atlantic's Ta-Nehisi Coates made a case for reparations for African Americans for centuries of enslavement and discrimination. A Los Angeles Times story offered it as an example of how the post-Obama left is being driven to big, unrealistic ideas. And Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders' stance against the idea made fodder for CNN and others, tracking the opinions of black people vis-a-vis the presidential election. But when, right on the heels of that, a UN human rights group released a report saying African Americans face systemic racial discrimination and deserve reparatory justice, that was not so newsworthy. The UN's working group of experts on people of African descent cited persistent gaps in, quote, almost all the human development indicators, such as life expectancy, income and wealth, level of education, housing, employment and labor, and even food security among African Americans and the rest of the U.S. population, close quote. And they point to police killings, zero tolerance policies in schools, the criminalization of poverty, environmental racism, discriminatory voter ID laws, and schools' insufficient teaching about the period of slavery as constituting a human rights crisis that must be addressed as a matter of urgency. While corporate media didn't agree, Jesse Holland, the AP's race, ethnicity, and demographics reporter, and himself black, wrote it up. The Denver Post ran a news brief. The Christian Science Monitor ran something online. Apart from that, it was only African-American-focused outlets like Essence Magazine and independents like Democracy Now! That saw any news in the news that an international organization thinks the idea of reparations for African-Americans is anything but silly. Black History Month is not off to a great start. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. It was lost on few that Flint, Michigan is a predominantly African-American and predominantly poor community. Some say that had nothing to do with the series of decisions that led to the poisoning with lead of Flint's water. But the work of our next guest explores the undeniable reality that across the country, there are environmental problems that disproportionately affect communities of color. Talia Buford is a reporter on the environment and labor team at the Center for Public Integrity. They are producing a series called Environmental Justice Denied. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Talia Buford.
Thank you.
Well, when news came out about the crisis of lead in the water in Flint, maybe not the first question, but the third or fourth question for many people was, where was the EPA? You know, where was the public advocate, if you will, in terms of preventing the situation or responding to it? What, in theory, would be the role of the EPA? Would they even have a role in such a situation as what we saw in Flint?
I think that what we see in Flint is a failure on a number of different levels, failure from the city level to the state level to the federal level. EPA has a role, of course, as an overseer of the Michigan Environmental Agency. The Michigan Department should be probably the one that has a bigger responsibility than the federal agency, since they are working in conjunction with the state. But I think that everyone here had something that they did where they fell off the job. Our series specifically looked at the EPA Office of Civil Rights, and that's a very specific program within the agency that looks at cases of environmental discrimination under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. They really are called into action when a complaint is filed to them. So for them, they almost have to wait. They don't have to. Well, they can wait until someone raises their hand and says, hey, there's a problem here. You should look into this. But that doesn't mean that there shouldn't have been someone else at either EPA or at the Michigan Environmental Agency saying, hey, these people are raising concerns. We should, at the very minimum, look into them.
A headline of a piece that you co-wrote recently was Environmental Racism Persists and the EPA is One Reason Why. Well, those are strong words. You've talked about the Office of Civil Rights. What did your investigation turn up about the actual track record of that office?
In our investigation, we looked at more than 15 years of complaints that citizens had filed to the EPA Office of Civil Rights. These are minority communities, often low income, but not always, who are saying, we live next to a sewage plant that makes it horrible for us to sit outside on our porches, or there are pesticides being sprayed on the fields next to our schools. So what we found is that over the 22-year history of the office, the agency has only had about 300 complaints, and they've never made a formal finding of a Title VI violation. They've made one preliminary finding, and there have been, you know, some investigations, but they've never come out and said, Texas or Indiana or, you know, whatever state, you are violating Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. And that struck us as something, especially over decades-long history, that you can't find one bad actor when we know that there are so many of these cases. We hear about them all the time. To hear that there's been no wrongdoing, it struck us as kind of odd. So in our investigation, what we also found is that only 12 of those cases that the EPA has found, they've closed with any actual official action. That means they've either negotiated or had some sort of informal settlement. The rest of them were all resolved among the complainants or the agencies or dismissed. And then even beyond that, there are several cases, almost 20, that have been just waiting in limbo, waiting for EPA to act in some way. In some cases, they've been waiting more than a decade.
On one level, it's a story of red tape, you know, blah, blah. But on the other hand, it really is having real world effects on people.
Sure, definitely. And I think that part of the problem becomes that it's very hard sometimes to prove a direct link between the cancer you get 5 years from now and the plant you lived next to when you were a kid or the facility that you worked at when you were just out of high school. That's one of the challenges of the environmental justice movement, having that scientific base and being able to prove that direct link between some of those health effects and the environmental factors that are surrounding really all of us.
Yeah, or being able to change the conversation towards one of a precautionary principle. You know, maybe you shouldn't have to wait until 20 years later and people have carcinomas, you know, to maybe we should kind of get out in front of it. And it's interesting because the EPA, it's not that they don't talk the talk. They do talk about, as you found, environmental racism, and that kind of is out of keeping with their actual inaction on the issue.
Well, I think that, to be fair to EPA, they have made some changes in response to our series and then also just kind of on their own examination. The director there, Velveeta Golightly-Howell, the director of the Office of Civil Rights, she's released a strategic plan that says, hey, we have this new case management system to track complaints and investigations, and here's how we're going to investigate claims, and here's a timeline we have for stepping up proactive reviews. On that same token, though, not all of the changes that they're proposing are welcome. Advocates are really worried about a rule that EPA is proposing, or may propose rather, that would eliminate a lot of the deadlines for responding to cases. And obviously one of the problems that we have here is that cases are sometimes stuck in limbo for a very long time. And a lot of the advocates are concerned that if you remove the one statutory like stick that citizens have to move the EPA into action, that it won't necessarily mean that the agency will be more nimble or more responsive, but that it just will cause more delay. From our interviews with people who are in the EPA or recently left, the people who work there, I don't think any of us doubted their actual sincerity or their commitment. I think that it's really a matter of the structure that they have to work within. Just being in the agency and in this political climate, I mean, EPA isn't a necessarily popular agency within the administration.
And I doubt that the Office of Civil Rights within the EPA is the most popular entity in the government or the best resourced or supported.
One thing the EPA has said is that they want to make sure that environmental justice is not just relegated to the Office of Civil Rights or the Office of Environmental Justice, and that it really should be an agency-wide priority. And I think that that's a valid point. You really need buy-in from all levels of the administration, of state regulators, of everyone from top to bottom, to really make the system work.
Your thoughts on journalistic coverage of this?
I was thinking about it kind of in the context of Flint, and I think that a lot of the local news media is paying attention, and there's been some amazing reporting and watchdogging that's been coming out of the Detroit Free Press and the Flint Journal, but a lot of this really comes down to people not being listened to, either by state officials and in some case by the national media. There's so much information that's just out there if you look for it. Our series was built on data that we pulled from the EPA that was publicly available. We were able to get it through a FOIA request. We actually created a database and made it public on our website so that people can tell their own stories using our data as well. So I think that these stories like Flint or other stories out of the Office of Civil Rights even can be a jumping off point for us to just start asking more about our communities and asking more about the world that we live in and looking for the data to back those questions up.
We've been speaking with Talia Buford. You can find her work and that of the whole Environmental Justice Denied series at the Center for Public Integrity's website, which is publicintegrity.org. Talia Buford, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
On many issues, Americans are happy to leave it to the experts. But when it comes to food, many people care very deeply. But wanting to make informed choices about what they eat and how it's produced sometimes leads people to ask questions that food industries would rather not answer. That's why journalism is so important and why it matters so much who appears in stories as an authority that we should listen to and believe. Our next guest brings a case study that shows why we are right to be mindful. A longtime food and agriculture journalist, Carrie Gillum, is now research director at U.S. Right to Know. She joins us by phone from Kansas. Welcome to Counterspin, Carrie Gillum.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, the Freedom of Information Act turns 50 this year, and I think it's hard to overstate its value to journalists and to the public. And I understand that FOIA played a role in the story that we're going to talk about. So before we get into what was revealed about former food science professor and media source Bruce Chassie, what do we know about how the information came to light?
Yeah, what we did at U.S. Right to Know was do Freedom of Information Act requests, actually at several different universities, and it's been a bit of a struggle to actually get those returned, but we have thousands of them, and we've been going through them to find out just exactly how closely are certain academics at publicly funded universities, how are they really working and aligning themselves if they are with private corporations that are trying to push certain political agendas and lobby for public policy matters. We wanted to see really what that relationship is, where is the money flowing, what are the connections, because we're getting the information that things weren't being revealed to the public that we thought were pretty important.
Well, when we talk about conflicts of interest between, for example, an academic and a industry with a particular set of ideas and policies that they want to promote and other ideas that they want to discourage, sometimes we're talking about maybe expensive dinners or perhaps travel that was covered to go to a conference. And these are things that even if they might seem to point to a kind of unseemly culture, they don't really, for many people, constitute a smoking gun. They don't seem like evidence of a quid pro quo. But when we talk about Bruce Chassie, who was a food science professor at the University of Illinois and at NIH for many years, that situation, which you've written about just recently, it seems much more stark than that.
Well, yeah. Now, I would agree with that. I have to admit that my jaw was dropped and hanging open most of the time I was reading these emails. It seems unbelievable to me that this is okay, that what we found doesn't seem to violate specific policies or ethics rules at the university, but it doesn't. But what the emails do show is that this particular professor, and he's one of, you know, many, but he's a very good example. This particular professor has a long track record, highly esteemed, and he and Monsanto Company in particular became very close and collaborated on a regular basis about a range of things, presentations that Chassis would make supporting genetically modified crop technology that Monsanto, you know, relies on, that Monsanto makes its $15 billion a year in revenues on. As you probably know, GMOs are pretty controversial right now. GMO labeling is at the forefront in Washington, D.C. for new legislation. Mandatory labeling is set to take effect in Vermont in July. The food industry is fighting that desperately. Monsanto has spent millions of dollars lobbying against state mandatory labeling measures across the country. So to have an academic who appears to be independent coming out and writing reports and making presentations and speeches and saying that consumers are wrong and GMOs are safe and we need them to feed the world and it's very sustainable and there's no safety issue and the pesticides that go with them are not a problem, you know, to have an independent academic standing up and saying all this is a wonderful thing for Monsanto. But what you see through these emails is that it was all very coordinated and very crafted by Monsanto and Monsanto PR operatives. Public relations firms are helping Chassis edit videos that he can put out. They're giving him slides for presentations. They're helping him set up a website where he can write negative critical articles about people who are raising concerns about GMOs. And there's a lot of money flowing back and forth, or actually one way, a lot of money flowing into accounts at the university for Chassis to use.
Yeah, and I would direct people to the website, to usrtk.org, to see examples from the emails that we're talking about. But we're talking about real direct stuff. You mentioned that presentation. Chassis is going to make a presentation in China, and there are emails that show him, you know, basically submitting what he's going to say to Monsanto and them making changes to it, you know, and him saying, all right, Monsanto will shape what I'm going to say about these set of issues. And then also on the other side, there's the money. There are the emails that connect it to a financial relationship between, in this case, the University of Illinois and, in this case, Monsanto.
Right, yeah. There are accounts set up where unrestricted funds, grants, donations, gifts can be sent from Monsanto, and Chassis can then access those funds and use them in different ways and for different projects. And there's no real problem with that, I guess, from the university. Now, Chassis, on his behalf, he says, hey, I believe GMOs are safe. You know, I'm a fan of GMOs, and so I'm not doing anything unethical. I'm not being bought. I'm not selling my integrity. But what you see in the emails is something that goes much deeper. I think he's not going to Monsanto and saying, hey, I'm going to make a presentation. I want to check the science on this and make sure I'm accurate. This is an active back and forth. How do we promote this? They talk about how to spin some information that's come out of the U.S. Geological Survey. Chassis offering how Monsanto might spin that because it doesn't on its face necessarily look too good. He's helping them figure out how to lobby the EPA to try to roll back regulations on biotech crops. He's asking for help getting first-class plane fare to go to India because he sure doesn't want to fly coach. I mean, there's a lot that we weren't able to put into our article, but it certainly shows a very hand-in-glove situation where this independent academic is very much promoting public policy issues for a private corporation.
Hiding the strings is important, and I think that's kind of where journalists come in, because there's a quote that you have from Monsanto's chief of global scientific affairs, Eric Sachs, in which he says, The key will be keeping Monsanto in the background so as not to harm the credibility of the information. In other words, they're explicit about the fact that they want these views to get out into the media and to public opinion, but to not seem to be tied to Monsanto, you know.
Exactly.
So again, that's where journalism comes in. And unfortunately, you find that journalists quoting Bruce Chassis in this case don't often do a great job of illuminating those connections.
Journalists don't. He's been quoted widely in many reputable newspapers, very large news outlets, and so are several others. There are several others around the country who journalists reach out to, of course, to ask for quotes on these very timely, you know, hot-button political issues. And I don't think it occurs to journalists. You know, I've been a journalist 25 years. It doesn't often occur to you if you're calling up to say, hey, talk to me about weed resistance and what's going on, you know, with glyphosate, or let's talk about the safety of GMOs. It doesn't often occur to you to say, hey, by the way, have you been emailing, you know, with Monsanto for the last 2 years and getting tens of thousands of dollars in unrestricted grants from them as I ask you your opinion on this subject? You know, it's not something you typically do as a journalist. You will do that if you're writing about a particular study, per se. You want to know who funded the study or who funded the research, but I think to me what all of this that we're seeing and we're finding tells me as a journalist is that we just need to be a lot more diligent. We need to really think about, is there something going on behind the scenes here? And even if we don't know, or even if we don't think they're going to tell us, we need to ask the question and get them on the record. Yes, there is a connection. No, because Kevin Folta, we had Kevin Folta emails from him at the University of Florida. He specifically said he had no relationship with Monsanto, wasn't taking money from Monsanto. And in fact, he got a $25,000 unrestricted grant and told Monsanto he was willing to write whatever they wanted him to write. But he sure wasn't telling the public that.
Exactly. It really is a kind of about the right to know. I mean, just as people want labels on GMO foods because different people feel differently about eating them, you know, we need, if you will, labels on our experts, not so that we can denounce them, but just so that we can know.
Exactly. You know, there may be some people who think that Bruce Chassis is that much more of an authority because he is so close with Monsanto. Maybe they would respect his opinion more. Granted, there are a lot of people on the other side who probably wouldn't trust the information. But without knowing those connections, without the disclosure and the transparency, and again, this is a man who was working for a public university, a taxpayer-funded university. We're all paying for that university. We're paying for these professors. And we should know the connections to private corporations. And, you know, we should be able to understand those collaborations. There should be transparency.
We've been speaking with Carrie Gillum of U.S. Right to Know. You can find them and their work online at usrtk.org. Carrie Gillum, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Three interviews this week, including two climate scientists. Andy Pittman, new science on how climate really hits us, plus Johan Rockström, the Swedish leader of planetary boundaries, followed by Lynn Benander on community power in New England. Let's go. It may get hotter where you are sooner than you think. New science reveals many parts of the world won't have to wait long to experience unsafe heating and disruptive changes in precipitation. Once again, we underestimate the climate threat. Dr. Andy J. Pittman is a British atmospheric scientist. Now he's the director of Australia's ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Pittman is co-author of a new piece in the journal Nature titled Allowable CO2 Emissions Based on Regional and Impact-Related Climate Targets. We'll see what that means. Andy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Okay, 2 degrees C of warming was supposed to be the safe line. Now it's not. But Andy, part of the world has already gone past 2 degrees C of warming, or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Where is that?
First of all, the 2 degrees being safe, it has never been a scientific target, as far as I know. It's always been a target agreed politically as something that's actually achievable. So for 2 degrees in the global mean warming, we would obviously anticipate major changes in climate, because we're observing major changes in climate for a global mean warming of less than 1 degree. And if we're seeing substantial changes in climate for less than 1 degree, it's a bit difficult to argue that 2 degrees is somehow safe. So, first of all, 2 degrees isn't a target that I think is safe, but it's much safer than 3 degrees. But a 2 degree increase in the mean obviously isn't a 2 degree increase in every single place on Earth. There is a very strong regional differentiation in how that global 2 degrees is made up. And on average, you would expect certain regions to warm by more and certain regions to warm by less. For example, the oceans have phenomenal inertia. They warm up more slowly than the land. So immediately you should be able to imagine that for a 2 degree global mean, you would expect the continental surfaces to warm by more than the ocean surfaces. Once you take the continental surfaces into account, then you're looking for places where there are feedbacks that would amplify the local warming. There's two particular things that one can imagine in the shorter term. One is where there is snow cover and that snow is melted earlier or never accumulates because of the warming, you get the well-known snow albedo feedback, where less snow means a darker surface that absorbs more radiation and gives you a stronger warming signal because there are mechanisms operating as a positive or a amplifying feedback on the warming in general. And the other classic example is a place where traditionally there's been quite a lot of soil moisture that tends to mean that the available energy is used for evaporative cooling. If those soils dry out, you don't get the evaporation. You instead exchange energy more as what's called sensible heat, which tends to amplify the warming. You can imagine for a global warming of 2 degrees, you would expect amplification over the continents and further amplification in particular regions where these important feedbacks can dominate the radiative forcing caused by elevated carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
All right. Now, we know the Arctic is quite a bit warmer than it used to be, and right about as we're doing this interview, it's incredibly warm. Do you worry about rising methane emissions in the Arctic, and should we take that as seriously as we do carbon dioxide?
One of the key things about our paper is that we expect there's a reasonable chance that most of the key tipping points are not likely to be exceeded for a regional warming of 2 degrees. We're not sure about that. It's not a certainty statement. It's a probability statement. So we think a lot of the tipping points are probably stable enough that if the local temperatures warm by 2 degrees, it's unlikely those tipping points would be triggered. However, we're seeing much, much more warming than 2 degrees over certain regions, one of which, as you point out, is the Arctic, for the reasons in part to do with the snow albedo feedback I talked about a few months ago. So for a global mean warming of 2 degrees, we're looking at warming of maybe 6 or 8 degrees over the Arctic. I think the probability of those tipping points being triggered with warming of 8 degrees is extremely likely. One of those key tipping points is the destabilization of the Arctic permafrost. When you melt the permafrost, you release the gases stored, and you also accelerate the rate of microbial activity in the soils. That tends to lead to very large releases in methane. And so one of my deep concerns is that for a global mean warming of 2 degrees, brackets a regional warming over the Arctic of 6 to 8 degrees, the tipping points that we're fearful of would indeed be triggered, leading to much larger releases in methane in those regions. And that is why I'm not at all confident that we will be able to limit warming to 2 degrees, because the so-called emission scenarios that enable the global mean temperature to be limited to 2 degrees don't take into account destabilization of some of the natural sinks and stores for carbon dioxide and methane. And I think we're going to destabilize those stores, and are in fact destabilizing those stores with 1 degree of warming. And therefore, it's very unlikely that somehow they'll remain stable as we go to 2 degrees in the global mean, given the new evidence that 2 degrees in the global mean means 6 degrees in the Arctic.
All right. Now, a decade ago, regional climate predictions were pretty hazy. How did your team manage to nail down the climate trajectory on a more local level?
We looked at all of the available climate models, and we didn't attempt to say this is what the warming will be. We looked at the range in warming that you obtain across all of the models, and we looked to see where the models were confident in that and where they were less confident. And obviously the climate models are more confident where the forcing is strongest. And because of the ice albedo feedback, I think the changes in the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere are areas we have considerable confidence over. I think we have less confidence over some of the changes that might take place in the tropics. And although it may not interest most of your listeners, one of the really interesting results we found is considerable uncertainty in the Southern Hemisphere, and we suspect that's because I suspect that's because some of the model development that's been done internationally has lacked particular focus on the Southern Hemisphere, because most of the modeling groups are in the Northern Hemisphere. So it all depends on where you're talking about. I think the very large amplification in the Arctic and some of the temperate zones is quite reasonably reliable. But even if it's not, it points to a risk. And I'd like people to stop thinking about what we know for sure and start thinking about where risks are emerging. Because in any other field, such as business, one develops one's business with a good understanding of risk, and one thinks about how to avoid those particular risks and minimize your vulnerability to external factors. And I think in climate science, we need to do very much the same in how we deal with global warming. We need to stop worrying about, are we sure about something, and be much clearer that what the models are telling us about are emerging risks, and those need to be managed in the same way as they would be managed in any other field.
I think that's a great point. I think you've just taught me something more. Well, let's get specific. Let's talk about one region in your study which will warm 2 degrees or more by 2030, which is only 15 years away. Why don't we start with your findings on the Mediterranean countries?
sort of builds on your earlier question. The Mediterranean is one of the places where there is extremely consistent results from the climate models. And I think the reason for that is to do with the particular synoptic situation that the Mediterranean finds itself in, and that it's warming due to the overall greenhouse effect. But there's also a soil moisture signal there, that you dry the Mediterranean even drier than it traditionally is, and as you dry the area, you reduce evaporation and you increase the direct heating from the land via the sensible heat fluxes, and that amplifies the overall pattern of warming for instance, 2 degrees. So we're not the first to draw attention to the Mediterranean. Many groups around the world have identified the Mediterranean as a particularly vulnerable region and a region that's particularly sensitive to mean warming. So in that sense, our results really for the Mediterranean are largely confirming results that are being found by earlier groups.
So what does overheating in the Mediterranean or other regions that you've identified tell us about the limits we need to set on global emissions?
So there is a so-called global emission limit of 1,000 billion tons, which has been talked about, and it was talked about in the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. A very important thing about that is that that 1,000 billion tons assumes no destabilization of natural stores of carbon or methane. And as I said earlier, I think that's incompatible with how we understand the Earth system to work. Taking it beyond that argument, if you want to avoid warming a region by more than 2 degrees, and we're able to show that for a global mean warming of 2 degrees, a particular region might warm by 4 degrees, it obviously means that you have to reduce the allowable emissions globally to substantially below 2 degrees. And that, I fear, is emerging from a lot of studies now, that 2 degrees isn't safe because a 2-degree warming is expressed over the land surface by warming of much more than 2 degrees. And it's not expressed as a sort of a regional average warming of 2 degrees. It's expressed, for instance, by earlier spring heat waves, or the ability of a landscape to continue to grow through a winter because the winter is several degrees warmer than it used to be, or it's expressed by summer heat waves lasting longer. And as your listeners would know, if you have a heat wave that traditionally lasts 3 days and it starts to last 5 days, the impacts that has on ecosystems, but also primarily on human health, can be way out of proportion to only an extra day or two. An important thing about our paper is not that if the globe warms by 2 degrees, the Mediterranean might warm by 4 degrees. It's how that warming takes place. And it isn't just everywhere gets a little bit warmer through the year. That warming tends to be concentrated in particular periods, and that can have profound impacts on human populations, but also a range of other socio-environmental factors.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. We're joined by atmospheric scientist Dr. Andy J. Pittman. I think the other startling result in this paper is the timing of climate impacts. We're used to reports talking about things happening by 2100, frankly, after we're dead. Now science has shortened that fuse. Serious impacts may be less than 15 years away. Did that surprise your team?
Not particularly, because whilst you're absolutely right in how you introduced that question, the climate scientists have been drawing attention to extreme events, which can in part be attributable to global warming, having occurred over the last few decades. So we are observing extreme events that can either be explained by global warming or have been amplified by global warming, or their probability has been increased by global warming over the last couple of decades. Now, if we have been observing very large changes in extreme events over the last decade, it's hardly surprising that we'll see that over the next couple of decades as warming intensifies. So I think our results aren't particularly surprising in that regard. I do think it's helpful to draw attention to the 2030s because it's obviously in the sort of timescales people plan for with infrastructure and a range of other things. But I don't want your listeners to think about global warming as a future impact. Anyone who works in climate science knows that we have been observing substantial changes over the last few decades, and indeed groups in ecology, groups in oceanography, groups in glacial sciences, and people working in areas of human health have clearly identified changes in the systems they're familiar with as a consequence of the observed changes to date. So think of global warming as a clear and present danger, not as something that we should be worried about evolving by 2030, for instance.
I have to ask you, though, for those countries that aren't going to warm faster, I mean, in Canada, people might welcome some warming. Do we need to worry less about climate change then, since it's not going to affect our country that fast?
If the warming was sort of a little warming on each day of the year, my experience of Canada, which have always been fantastic, suggests that that wouldn't be in any sense catastrophic. But it ain't like that. That's not how warming happens. If you manage to warm a region of eastern or western Canada by 3 degrees on the annual average, but all that warming happens in July, the amount it warms in July is vastly more than 3 degrees, and you start to get serious heat wave conditions. Now, I remember summers in Toronto being really quite hot, and you don't necessarily want to start experiencing extreme heat wave conditions in Canada. For a start, it triggers extraordinary vulnerability around forest fires. It also tends to trigger ecological changes, which can weaken ecosystems, which makes them much more vulnerable to fire. It can have profound impacts if the heat wave conditions occur at the wrong timing of the phenology of your wheat production, for example. So it sounds quite attractive in one sense if you do warm a region by a couple of degrees, but that isn't how it works. That warming would tend to be concentrated in relatively short periods, be a lot more than a couple of degrees, and if your systems have been built or your farming practices have been built with a certain climate in mind, and you start getting events well outside the observed range, it can have really major impacts on your economy, on your ecology, and on your populations. So no, I don't think it's a good news story for Canada. If we were able to warm your winter by a couple of degrees, that might sound like a good idea, but I don't think that's how things will actually eventuate.
All right. Given that, what further science do we need, and what are the limits to how small you think we can go with these predictions?
The major science that's necessary is perhaps not that important. And as a scientist, arguing that we don't need more science is not a particularly common narrative. It is very attractive for the climate science community to be able to build better models informed by better data, finessing the spatial detail at much higher resolution. So there have been calls, which I would strongly support, for instance, of being able to get the climate models down to, say, a 20-kilometer spatial resolution so that there's certain characteristics of the atmosphere that we would begin to capture much more explicitly, and I think we'd build better predictive skill and a whole range of things like that. But the main message from our paper is that we have probably erred too generously on the emissions that have been discussed across the global community, and we have probably erred as a science community in being a little conservative in how fast climate can change, and we have also had our eye on the averages more so than the extremes. Now, that's a general statement. There are some outstanding groups in North America and in Europe that have focused on extremes. But in general, the climate community has been really interested in how much will the global average warm. And I think what our paper says is it doesn't matter really what the global average warms. It matters critically on how climate warms spatially by country and how that warming is translated into days of heat or cold or days of extreme rainfall, because those are the things that can break a drainage system, break a health system, damage an ecosystem. So most of what I think our paper is about is a call to indicate that we have been too generous on the scale of emissions that should be permitted. But if I was going to take the science further, I would encourage the research communities to be targeting the nature and the statistics of extreme events into the future over how much the planet as a whole will warm.
Please tell us about the lead author of this paper.
Sonia Senaratne, she's a professor at ETH in Zurich. She has a long, quite phenomenal career in climate science. She was the lead author, for instance, on what's called the SREX report, which you can Google, which is our state-of-the-art knowledge of how extremes exist and occur within the climate system.
Is there anything else that I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners?
I think really just to sum up, what our paper has highlighted are how extremes will change at regional scales, that it's not just the average that matters, and it's how those extremes will change by region or by country that's very important. And I'm hoping that one of the things that will flow from this is that countries will begin to do a systematic assessment of their vulnerability to significantly more warming than they have assumed with the 2 degrees. So if countries have been looking at their vulnerability to 2 degrees of warming, they're missing the point. They need to know what their country will warm by, and they then need to look at the systems within that country and see whether their systems are resilient to warming of 3, 4, 5 degrees. And if a country like Canada can demonstrate it's resilient to warming in certain periods of the year of 4 degrees or 5 degrees, well, you may have some time to build improved socioeconomic and environmental systems to withstand additional warming. But my guess is that most countries will discover that they are extremely vulnerable economically and environmentally and socially to the sorts of regional scale warmings that we describe in this paper. And perhaps it's a bit of a wake-up call that 2 degrees ain't safe, and many of our countries are more vulnerable to global warming than the public have generally assumed.
Dr. Andy J. Pittman is the director of Australia's ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science. He's at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. You can find out more information on all of this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Andy, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
There are limits to what humanity can do on this planet and still survive. Johan Rockström has led a team that mapped out those planetary boundaries. Rockström is the executive director of the Stockholm Resilience Center. He teaches at Stockholm University and holds many roles in the scientific community. We'll talk about his latest book, written with Matthias Klum, Big World, Small Planet. Johan Rockström, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and a great honor to be with you.
One boundary set by world governments in Paris was to avoid heating the planet 2 degrees C above the pre-industrial levels. Some scientists say 2 degrees of warming is already built in. We're heading into the danger zone. Do you agree or disagree?
No, I agree. You know, the planetary boundary science, which is the basis of the book Big World, Small Planet, concludes exactly in line with what you're saying, that the climate planetary boundary, in fact, is even lower than 2 degrees Celsius. We put it at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the aim that the Paris Climate Agreement in the end really, really set out for, which means that it aligned itself with science. Now, the drama here is that we have already warmed the planet with an average temperature rise of 1 degree Celsius. But a lot of science indicates clearly that we are very soon, if not already today, committed to almost 1.5 degrees Celsius because of all the heat which is stored in the ocean and because of the cooling caused by air pollution, which is a paradox that actually air pollution, which destroys the health of people, is actually helping us by cooling the planet by basically shedding away incoming solar radiation. So we are probably close to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and we're moving very quickly towards 2 degrees Celsius. So yes, there is a danger zone there. However, there is a lot of evidence on the plate today showing clearly that we can transition towards a decarbonized future faster than we have previously thought, thanks to the ability to scale economically attractive renewable energy technologies, from photovoltaics to wind power to biomass to different forms of, you know, hydro and even nuclear to some extent, which can allow us to transition quickly. And what science also shows very clearly is if we want to settle at around 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, meaning below 2 degrees Celsius, we will not only have to decarbonize and leave the fossil fuel era behind us within, you know, 30, 40 years, we also need to transition into a phase in the second part of this century where we have negative emissions, meaning we take out more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than we are emitting into the atmosphere. And this can be done by working both with nature, using biomass, for example, plants and trees that take up carbon dioxide and transform it into charcoal and plug it back into the soil, or through different kinds of geoengineering systems, which we call carbon capture and storage, where you backplug technologies in coal-fired plants, for example, to suck out carbon dioxide, concentrate it, and suck it back into the crust of the earth. So even though it's absolutely true that we are in a very dire situation and there's an urgency, there is increasing evidence that a transition into a world below 2 degrees Celsius, below the climate planetary boundary, is actually doable, even though the situation is challenging.
Under a high emission scenario, if we don't make that, I have seen maps projecting wide bands of deserts around the subtropics in this century. You are known for in-depth research on water resources and how to farm with less. Can we cope with changes to agriculture under climate change?
Yeah, this is a very important question. Now, and there are two parts of answer. I mean, one is where you started off. You're absolutely right. We are following a pathway. If we continue business as usual, if we do not implement what we have now promised from heads of state of all the world's countries to do in Paris, then yes, we would be first hitting right through the ceiling of the climate planetary boundary of staying under 2 degrees, and we would very likely take us to 3-4 degrees Celsius, which can be described in no other way than being a disastrous future for humanity, from the drought-prone agricultural regions in the center of the U.S. all the way to the tropical, vulnerable countries across Africa and the low-lying island states in the Indian and Pacific Oceans that would have to be evacuated even. So yes, that would be a very dangerous scenario, and the number one victim is everything that depends on fresh water, and among those is really food production as the first victim. But on the other hand, we can see, as I mentioned earlier, the possibility of transitioning in line with the Paris Agreement to avoid those most dangerous outcomes, meaning that passing 2 degrees Celsius, it would still require clearly major investments in adaptation. Remember that the last time we had 1 degree Celsius warming, and when the planet finally stabilized itself after that disequilibrium caused by 1 degree warming, we had on average 6 meter sea level rise on Earth. So, you know, we're very likely, even if we wouldn't reach that high level of change, to be forced to invest heavily in dealing with the rising frequency of droughts, rising frequency of heat waves, rising frequency of disease, and an irreversible increase in sea level rise. So, you know, however we twist and turn this, we will have to adapt to unavoidable change, but we have to avoid unmanageable change.
Now, at a TED talk, Johan, you told an audience that climate change may not actually be our greatest challenge. What did you mean by that?
Yes, and that is scientifically supported, even though I recognize how provocatively it can appear, because, of course, the global climate crisis is debated and at the center stage of our focus, and, of course, it is a major, major challenge. However, we are at the sixth mass extinction of species in the world. We are, therefore, as human beings, killing off everything from pollinators to large predators like tigers and cod and sharks at a pace equivalent with a global mass extinction. among these six mass extinctions, by the way, is, for example, when we lost the dinosaurs some 65 million years ago due to an asteroid catastrophe. So we are in a very, very dire situation with regards to losing biodiversity. Now, remember that losing species on this Earth is not a moral issue just to protect everyone's right to exist as living beings. It is really our toolbox to allow ourselves to have a good well-being on this planet, because we need biodiversity to, you know, capture carbon, clean water, have good quality of air, and to produce food. So there's no other way than, you know, maintaining nature to have a good future. Now, the dilemma is the following. These are two crises, biodiversity crisis, climate crisis. However, the climate crisis has a perfect substitution. We can follow the conventional economic theory to say, okay, we recognize that oil, coal, and natural gas is too dangerous, it's too costly, and therefore does not deliver. And moreover, we're reaching a situation with peak of cheap fossil fuel sources, such as oil. So we transition into a substitute and therefore can deliver modern energy supply through solar voltaics, wind, biomass, hydro, nuclear, and other innovations. This is what economic theory has always as the way we can move towards innovation and development. And we're seeing evidence that this can be done. So we actually have a solution, which moreover can deliver for human well-being. How is it on biodiversity? Well, you see, there's no substitute. You lose a species and it's gone forever. There's no regret period. You lose fresh water, or when you run out of fresh water, there's no alternative. So biodiversity and what we call the living nature, fresh water, land, biodiversity, has no substitution. There's only one way and one solution, which is to safeguard the natural capital we have. And that is much tougher because it requires that we understand the need to preserve what we have to allow our children and future generations to thrive on Earth. So that is why I'm saying that perhaps we might find in the end, paradoxically, that the climate challenge is the easier one because we actually have a substitutable, economically viable solution, while biodiversity is a much more complex and spread and deeper and fatal outcome.
Johann, what is the fourth industrial revolution and what could that mean?
Yeah, so this is both a great excitement but also a concern if we, so to say, allow it to live on its own. The fourth industrial revolution is the notion, which is backed up by more and more evidence and coming not least from the great innovation powerhouses in the U.S., from Silicon Valley to MIT and then the great corporations you have in the U.S., showing that we are right at the verge, as we speak right now, starting a new exponential journey into the digital revolution going to scale in the world, nanotechnology, biotechnology, allowing us to truly be able to think of a world where we can achieve basically abundance for all in the world by taking a major step in terms of delivery of goods and services thanks to or because of technological advancements, and that this is going very, very fast. Now, that is good news. It allows us to move and take a major next step into a modern future in the 21st century. The challenge, though, is the following. We know, if you look into the past, that essentially all technological advancements have accelerated our journey towards unsustainable development. It has sped up our ability to undermine resources and ecosystems and climate on Earth. So if an industrial revolution is allowed to occur on its own, it could actually accelerate our journey towards hitting these planetary boundaries even more severely. So our hypothesis in the Big World Small Planet, what we're suggesting is that a fourth industrial revolution has to be capped by planetary boundaries. And perhaps surprising to many is that our very deep conviction is that that would not halt the industrial revolution. It would rather deepen it even further. You know, if you say, oh, it's not enough to be really, really superbly innovative when it comes to the next generation of vehicles or next generation of aviation or next generation of smartphones, they also have to now be entirely sustainable, possible to recycle, and occur within a safe operating space. I believe that that would deepen the innovation even further and make us even smarter. So there's no contradiction between planetary boundaries and the fourth industrial revolution, but it's an exciting but also very challenging moment.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the Swedish scientist Johan Rockström. In your book, Johan, you say we can trigger a new wave of sustainable technological inventions to solve our ecological crisis. I just talked with another well-known Swede, Alf Hornborg. Alf says there is no technical solution to the problems of technology. We need social and ideological change instead. What are your thoughts?
Yes, and I know Alf Hornborg very well, and he raises a very important issue, and I'm so glad you bring this forward, because it's absolutely true. There's no convincing analysis to show that technological breakthroughs alone can take us towards a sustainable and equitable future with 10 billion co-citizens when we're a big world on a small planet. In fact, the pace by which we need to decarbonize our climate system, share the remaining rare earth metals, produce more than 50% food to feed humanity on existing land because we cannot expand into virgin ecosystems anymore. We cannot empty the oceans from more wild fish because we're running out of fish. These insights force us to recognize that technology can take us a certain part of the way, but we also need behavioral change, and that requires value change and particularly equity change. I mean, it's equally dramatic that we are a rich minority, some 1.5 billion of 7.2 billion people, who has caused the bulk of the global environmental risks on planet Earth. And it's equally, you know, acute to recognize that that minority is equivalent to the inequity challenge we're facing with, you know, a small percentage of the world's population owning more capital than 50% of the poorest in the world. So it's absolutely true that we have to combine a fourth industrial revolution not only with a deep sustainability mind shift, but also with a deep equity and values mind shift, and that all of this will require from us all a sense of behavioral change and lifestyle change, which has to be founded on the recognition that we have to share the remaining ecological space on Earth. But I really want to emphasize that that ethical dimension and this lifestyle change, there's no evidence to suggest that that's a sacrifice, that this is, you know, moving backwards. It's rather moving forward into the future. And I really want to remind ourselves that the real sacrifice, the time we would really have to give up on our lifestyles, is by continuing business as usual. Because business as usual is what all science shows will take us across tipping points, which would undermine our ability to have good lives. And therefore, the most dire sacrifice to our lifestyles is by continuing as usual. A sustainable future is so to say, the only pathway that could plausibly give us the room to allow ourselves to have a good future. So, you know, you have to combine these issues, but recognizing that a modern, thriving future is today basically prerequisited by a sustainable framework.
Well, given our situation, what are the most urgent problems we need to tackle first?
Well, our conclusion in the Big World Small Planet is that we have two major, let's say, urgent transformations we need to accomplish. And the first one is, not surprisingly, to bend the curve of emission of greenhouse gases and move rapidly towards a decarbonization of our entire world economy, which means leaving fossil fuels behind us. The number one issue is to halt all use of coal and coal-fired plants, deregulate or stop using oil and natural gas and move into renewable energy technologies. That is de facto an urgent challenge we face. And the second one is to transition into sustainable food production in the world, because it may surprise you that agriculture is the single largest cause behind us threatening planetary boundaries. Food production is the single world largest emitter of greenhouse gases. Agriculture is the single world's largest consumer of fresh water, the single world largest polluter of our waterways due to too much nitrogen, phosphorus, and chemicals, and the single largest loss of biodiversity. So sustainable food means a healthy planet. And moreover, which is quite interesting, is that sustainable food can also unlock many of the strategies towards more healthy diets. So I would say that the two most urgent challenges is to move towards a renewable energy future and a sustainable food future. And that would take us a long way in terms of a future within planetary boundaries.
And there is a program that you're involved in called Future Earth. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yes. You see, the planetary boundary framework, which then lands scientifically at the conclusion that we now need to define the Earth system processes that regulates the stability and resilience of the Earth system, and that we have to quantify biophysical boundaries within which we can have a safe future on a stable planet. All that evidence arises from 30 years of extraordinary advancement in global change research, what we call Earth system science, which simply put is the science of understanding how the Earth operates and also how we humans interact with Earth. Now, that science started in the 1970s and has progressed in a number of large international programs, from the World Climate Research Program to something called the International Human Dimensions Program and the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, looking at land and climate and atmosphere and interactions with the world economy. Now, some 5 years ago, the recognition was that now we have so much evidence that we're facing this urgent need to transform the world towards a global sustainable future that this enormous advancement in Earth system science needs to take a next step, needs to basically integrate social natural sciences and needs to focus more on science exploring pathways for a sustainable future. And after a long consultation among scientists across the world, with stakeholders from business and policy and civil society, the result is Future Earth. So Future Earth is a step up of the global sustainability science community, from climate change to biodiversity to economics, to start and really address the integrated challenges and opportunities facing humanity to transition into a global sustainable future. And Future Earth has just started. It has, interestingly, a distributed headquarters where the U.S. is one of the hubs for the global leadership, based in Colorado, with a number of top scientists across the U.S., one hub in Sweden, one in Canada, one in Japan, and one in France. And Future Earth has the objective of being, you know, a science platform for collaborative research, searching solutions for humanity's transition towards a stable and resilient future.
For your book, Big World, Small Planet, you didn't team up with another scientist, but with a fairly famous photographer. You started talking about the role of beauty. What has beauty got to do with science and policy?
Yes, this might be surprising that a scientific conclusion after 30 years of Earth system science, combining, you know, linking climate science to complex research on ocean acidification, lands at a conclusion that a key message to humanity is that if we can safeguard the remaining beauty on Earth, we stand a very good chance of a prosperous future. And that might be surprising, but, you know, there's something fundamental here, and it is about the collision between emotions and the rational, between brain and heart, represented in the Big World, Small Planet with the science that we summarize and with the photography that Matthias is displaying. But our conclusion is serious, which is that we live in a world of rising cultural and religious and political turbulence. And we focus so much of our efforts on everything that is so different between the Muslim world and the Christian world and the North and the South, etc., and all the divides we have. But our hypothesis is that we have a universal value. We have a universal value across every culture, every nation, every corner of this planet, which is that every individual has a relationship to his or her nature at home, and that this nature is what we define as beauty, and that if we can safeguard the beauty we know, and if we all can do that, we stand a good chance of that adding up towards safeguarding the beauty of the planet. So if you look out of your window, what you really care for in nature, be it your closest tree or a little meadow or, as I have, just a little rocky spot on the coast of the Baltic Sea outside of the island where I live, these are fundamental, valuable, not to say prerequisites, for us to have a good planet that can continue to deliver human well-being. So the point is that, you know, coming back to this fundamental core of sustaining the beauty can be a key part of our mind shift towards a sustainable, innovative transformation in the future.
I have to agree, it's beauty that powers me and keeps me going even in difficult times. From Stockholm, we've been speaking with Johan Rockström, one of the world's preeminent natural scientists, I think I can say. Johan is co-author of the book Big World, Small Planet. He's the executive director of the Stockholm Resilience Center and teaches at Stockholm University. You can find links to his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Johan, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to this very important program.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
What is the answer to giant power companies with equally giant greenhouse gas emissions? Citizens doing it for themselves. One of the best examples is co-op power in New England. We'll find out what it is and how this could work in your community from Lynn Benander. She's the CEO of Co-op Power and Northeast Biodiesel. From Massachusetts, Lynn, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Very nice to join you today.
Why don't we start with Co-op Power? What is that?
Co-op Power is a decentralized network of community energy cooperatives serving Massachusetts and southern Vermont. And we help people build community ownership of energy solutions in their community that they're really looking to help them get off of fossil fuels, reduce their energy costs, and build their local economies.
Well, many of us would like to get something like this started. Can you tell us, how did Co-op Power get off the ground?
There were many similar efforts that kind of were small streams that contributed to what we're doing. And I think the first impetus for our creation came from someone working for the Department of Public Utilities in the state of Vermont. And they were looking out for consumers and said, you know, the electric industry is deregulating, and in Massachusetts, we don't have many municipally owned energy companies. We don't have any rural electric cooperatives that serve most of the rest of the United States. And so there isn't a real consumer voice in Massachusetts and not as much either in Vermont. So he was concerned that consumers were going to need more representation as the energy industry changed, and asked us to work together to create local solutions for communities related to the energy industry.
When I heard about this, my first reaction was to picture a group of middle-class white folks getting together to bypass the system and save a few bucks. Your website suggests something quite different. Who is participating?
Yeah, we're a multi-class and multi-race cooperative. In some of our early meetings, our business planning meetings often included a couple hundred people, and we were presenting each option as we went along. And one of the options that was presented was doing solar electric installations on the roof of our members' homes. And as we were discussing that proposal, there was kind of a rumble in the room, and I was facilitating and kind of was looking around trying to figure out what was the dis-ease that was building. And when I asked, I said, it seems like some people are uncomfortable with us talking about this proposal. What's happening? And some people stood up and said, this is just solutions for wealthy people on their homes. And if you don't own a home, you can't access. And we thought Co-op Power was going to be here for us, including renters and people with limited income. And so they said, you know, we don't really want Co-op Power focusing on this particular product and services. We want Co-op Power focusing on things that are more accessible across income, across different kinds of communities. And the rest of the members resonated with that. And we made a much more focused commitment to making sure that what we do is available to everybody.
The banks aren't known for being super friendly to people who want to do things for themselves. How did you get around that?
We've raised a lot of money from our members. When people saw something they wanted to see happen, they would invest in it together. One of our members, for example, lent money to a church in a low-income community in Boston so that that church could do energy efficiency upgrades and, you know, get paid back. The church has paid back our member over time. So we've had partnerships between our members and people that wanted to get good stuff done on their buildings, on their homes. And we've also had people volunteer. So we get 15 people that can go out and put up a solar hot water system on somebody's house with volunteer labor. And if you help 4 people do it, then they'll come help you do it on your house. So we are able to leverage that kind of community support to get the costs way down.
In your experience, are people less likely to default on community-financed projects?
It's funny, that's not really a word in our vocabulary. We're working together to make things happen, and there's a movement in the United States called the slow money movement, and it's really about patient capital that's very committed to building local economies, to building local food solutions, and I would say we're part of that slow money movement, building local energy solutions. And so the payment terms aren't always on time, but there's a full commitment to making things whole over time.
Lynn Benander, could you tell us about your experience in helping set up individual entrepreneurs, say in solar or whatever, versus getting other co-ops going?
We've helped 6 companies get started as solar installation businesses. That's been an interesting experience for us. One of the first projects we worked on was helping a employee-owned cooperative get started in building mostly solar electric systems. They've done some solar hot water. Their name is PV Squared, and we helped write their first business plan and get first grants in for them. They've grown so much over the last 10 years, and they're very highly respected in the field, and they're the installer that we've chosen to build our first community shared solar project. We're really proud of them and all that they've accomplished, and we're so delighted that they're still around to help us to do good work in the world, to partner with us. We've also helped individuals start solar installation businesses, and most of those have sold off to other businesses, and they're not available to us anymore. And then there's one exception, Renewed by the Sun in Turner's Falls, has continued to provide support for us.
So as I understand it, there's sort of subgroups of co-ops that work with Co-op Power. Could you explain how that works and maybe tell us how many people work with Co-op Power and then how many employees the whole group of co-ops might employ, if you know?
Yes. Co-op Power is one cooperative. We have 30 staff people that work out of 2 locations, one in the Boston area, connected to the Boston Metro East Community Energy Co-op, and one in Hatfield, Massachusetts, that's connected to the Hamden Community Energy Co-op, Franklin Community Energy Co-op, and Hampshire Community Energy Co-op. And those 2 locations provide energy efficiency services to 30 to 40 homes a week, as well as a whole range of all the other products and services that we offer. But most of our staff work in the energy efficiency division.
And what pays off fastest in New England? Is it solar electricity or solar hot water heaters? And also, I want to know, is it possible for solar hot water heaters to still work in cold New England winters?
Solar hot water is a great solution here in New England. And if there were not public subsidies, solar hot water would be by far the best investment, because there's quite a lot of money, especially in Massachusetts, but also in Vermont, incentives that encourage people to build solar electric systems. Those are also quite cost effective. But the best investment for anybody, anytime, is in energy efficiency. That's where you're going to get the biggest bang for every dollar you spend to air seal it and insulate it so that it uses a lot less energy for both heating and cooling.
Let's move on, Lynn, to biodiesel. What is Northeast Biodiesel?
Northeast Biodiesel is a project that was initiated by our Franklin and Hampshire community energy cooperatives about 10 years ago. And it's actually a manufacturing plant that's going to be launching next month that will make 1.75 million gallons a year of biodiesel that we can use in our oil heat systems and diesel engines. And it's the biodiesel that we're making is made from recycled cooking oil from restaurants and cafeterias and food processing centers.
Right, because biodiesel got a terrible name as a false solution, I think, when industrialized agriculture switched from growing food to making heavily subsidized gas substitutes. So I guess this is quite different from that.
It is, and yet that whole process, the public perception process that biodiesel went through when it was connected more with virgin soy biodiesel and ethanol, that whole transformation in the industry where biofuels were sexy and hot, and everybody wanted to be a part of that revolution, and then all of a sudden, you know, we were on the most wanted list, and people were very confused about what was good and what wasn't good. And the kind of biodiesel we've been working to produce from the beginning is a very positive environmental contribution. It's the only way that tractors and construction vehicles and trucks and buses can move with clean fuel. And so we have these large diesel vehicles, and this is the best fuel for them to use as we're transitioning off of fossil fuels and into a cleaner economy that burns 86% cleaner than diesel fuel. So reducing our carbon emissions and particulate emissions is a very important part of our transition to a cleaner economy. I got a chance to hear Mary Powell from Green Mountain Power speak. So she runs a utility in southern Vermont. She was such a breath of fresh air. She's talking about what the utility of the future looks like. She's working in a small town of Rutland, Vermont, looking at how to take that very limited resource community off the grid. I think there are visionaries within the utilities that are looking at what it means now with the development of distributed generation, what kinds of possibilities are available for really improving the lives of people in our communities.
So, Lynn, does your work with Positive Solutions help you deal with worries about climate change and our future?
Absolutely. I remember when my children were small, I read a study about whether children were afraid of nuclear holocaust. When I was a kid, I had to sit underneath my desk, you know, during these little drills where we were taught what to do if there was a nuclear bomb that fell near us. And there was a study that showed that if the children's parents were working for solutions for a more peaceful way of settling our conflicts and looking for ways to get rid of the nuclear weapons, that those children whose parents were involved in those were more hopeful. And I made a commitment to my own children to be involved in creating positive solutions, because I think having hope is one of the things that helps us keep our humanity. And when we lose hope, we end up doing things that really compromise ourselves and our communities.
Well, I realize this whole project has been many years in the making, but if you could speak to some of our listeners who say, yeah, I want co-op power in my community, are there two or three steps that they can start to get the ball rolling?
So on our website, which is co-oppower.coop, there's a section that says bring co-op power to your community that describes how you might go about doing that. And if you're in a community in New England or New York, we would be glad to talk with you about partnering with you to help create a community energy co-op. And if you're outside of New England or New York, we're also very happy to share the resources that we have on our website. We try to make many things available. There's also a lot of groups that we're connected to around the country and in other parts of the world that are working on very similar things, and we've got some of those links on our website, and we're also glad to share, you know, to talk more with people too, especially by email. That's the best way to get in touch with us.
So we've been talking with Lynn Benander, the CEO of Co-op Power and Northeast Biodiesel in New England. Find out more at co-oppower.coop. And you can find links to Lynn and everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Lynn. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you very much for having us on.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
We are out of time. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
It stops.
You can't drag me into this. You can't.
All I want to do is drag the truth out of you.
I've told you the whole truth.
But we're joined now by Zafar Benkash, crescent-online.org. Are you there, sir?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Thank you very much for joining us. You're batting cleanup today because we have big problems we have to understand. There's,
no problem.
We thought there was going to be a meeting in Geneva, but it seems to be stalled.
That's right, yes.
And one, I saw an article by, I think it's Finian Cunningham.
Yes.
Where he says the problem is America and the Saudis can't get their act together because when they come on stage, it's going to be clear that they are allies of ISIS.
That is correct. In fact, both the Saudis and the Americans have been pushing to include two terrorist groups. They go by the name of Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham. Both are part of ISIS and al-Qaeda linked groups, and they have, of course, been involved in a lot of horrible things. Jaish al-Islam, for instance, was responsible for the Ghouta chemical attack back in August of 2013, which was essentially meant to provoke the U.S. into attacking Syria because Barack Obama had declared the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government as a red line. But when these terrorists used it, of course, you know, he didn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. But although he was about to go to war against Syria, but then the British intelligence notified the Americans that their analysis showed that the chemical composition of those chemicals that was used was not the kind that the Syrian army possesses, mm-hmm. and that these are weapons that were supplied to these terrorists by the Saudis and the Turks. And so that's the kind of group that the Americans and the Saudis now want to include in the Geneva talks, which, according to the UN representative for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, he said that these have been postponed until Friday, although it is difficult to know whether they actually would be held on Friday. And he even said that while we are still working on what groups to include in these talks. The talks are not going to be direct. They will be indirect talks in the sense that one set of people, which presumably is the Syrian government's representatives, sitting in one room, and the opposition groups, whatever groups are allowed to participate, would be sitting in another room, and mediators would be going back and forth between them. Mm-hmm. So that's the scenario that that stands at the present time. But, I mean, this is, as you said at in your intro, that the Americans and the Saudis are pushing for terrorist groups to be included in the negotiations, and that clearly exposes their ultimate links and who is behind these terrorists that have caused so much mayhem, killings, and all kinds of other terrible things in Syria over the past 5 years.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, we really, you know, the last time we spoke to you, and you were pointing out there are serious cracks showing, and particularly with Saudi Arabia, they are having trouble using this expression, well known, that they can't get their act together. They stumbled in a big problem in Iraq recently where their emissary there, their ambassador, identified the people's militia, part of the government forces of Iraq, as being ethnically or sectarian lined, and And it was so shocking that an Iraq complained, and then the leader of the
Saudi foreign minister, if that's what he called him.
Yeah. He said, oh, the man was, that's not our position.
Yes.
So I thought people had to resign when those things happened. You know?
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia is digging itself into a deeper and deeper hole. You know, I'm sure you've heard the expression that when you are in a hole,
if you want
to get out of it, the first thing to do is to stop digging. but I guess the Saudis don't know that.
Yeah. they don't do manual labor, you know.
That's correct.
Clearly they are going to be – they're a damaged party going to these talks. There's another group, though. I want to make sure we understand who they are, because the Turkish government is very upset that I believe that Russia and Syria said they were okay with a group called the YPG participating.
Yes.
Now, who is the YPG and why does Turkey object?
Yes. Now, the YPG is a Kurdish group, which basically is an abbreviation for Yakiniyen Parastina Gael, which in Kurdish is translated into People's Defense Unit. So it's a Kurdish militia that is tied to the Kurdish Supreme Committee. It's an armed militia, and it has been operating in the northeast of Syria, where this particular group obviously has fought against these ISIS terrorists and liberated considerable territory from their control. But what Erdogan's problem is that he does not want this Kurdish group that is based in Syria to link up with the Kurds in Turkey, because it's Erdogan who is really has gone out on a very extreme position against the Kurds. In fact, he targeted them deliberately last year in Turkey and even tore the agreement that he had, peace agreement that he had signed with them back in 2012 in order to arouse Turkish nationalism. And of course, he was somewhat successful in the sense that he won a majority in the parliamentary election.
He runs for office by opposing Kurds, right?
That is correct.
So he's the one who's going to crush the Kurds.
That's right. So he, first of all, he was the one who had signed a peace agreement with them in 2012, which was, of course, applauded by a lot of people. People saw that as a very sensible approach. And even the Kurds were very happy with it because they felt that at long last there was a government that was willing to sit down and talk rather than shoot. But then Erdogan decided that he was not going to have that, so he tore up the agreement and started shooting and created a lot of chaos in Turkey itself. But of course, by appealing to the jingoistic feelings of the Turks, he won the elections, but I don't think that he would get away with this because this is going to cause a lot of problems for Turkey in the medium and long term. And so Erdogan's real problem is that he does not want the YPG to be represented in the Geneva talks because, number one, it would not only grant this Kurdish group recognition, but it will also enhance their status among the Kurds. And so more and more Kurds would then turn to the YPG, and also it would enhance the stature of the Kurds in Turkey, particularly the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And so Erdogan sees that as a threat to Turkish sovereignty as well as his own rule in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And it also undermines his position of trying to destabilize the Syrian government because of late the Syrian army has been making good progress against these terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. And so if YPG were represented in the Geneva talks, then that would be a further blow to Erdogan's policies in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Further to that, there's three or four prominent well-known names who have led the Kurdish community or known abroad, like Mr. Barzani and I forget the other family's name, but
Talabani and so on.
Mr. Talabani. Do they comment on this situation?
Well, they haven't, because they are quite comfortably established in Iraqi Kurdistan. So they have not really openly said anything about it. But, I mean, from the Kurdish point of view, the inclusion of YPG cannot be a bad thing, because obviously the Kurds have historically struggled not only for their linguistic and political rights, but they've also been struggling to establish an independent Kurdish state. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is going to affect a whole lot of countries, including Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Syria, and parts of Armenia, mm-hmm. which would essentially redraw the borders of these countries, and it would be a major destabilizing fact mm-hmm. Or factor if it were to materialize. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, although in Iraq the Kurds have achieved de facto independence, in the other places, currently, of course, in Turkey, they are fighting against Turkish forces. In Syria, they have got fairly a broad degree of autonomy because the Syrian army is unable to reach there. And in any case, the Syrian army is engaged in so many other areas that it has left the Kurdish region to the YPG, as well as the Kurdish Supreme Committee, and also aligned with the Democratic Union Party, which is another Kurdish party. Mm-hmm. So the Syrian government is happy for these groups to keep the terrorist groups away from certain areas of Syria so that the Syrian army can concentrate elsewhere. You'd recall Kobani, which was there was fighting taking place in 2014 between the terrorist groups, the ISIS groups, as well as the Kurds, and from there they were the Kurds were ultimately able to drive away the terrorists, and so the group that was involved in fighting was the YPG that mm-hmm. fought against the terrorists, drove them out of there. And then, of course, last June they also took another major town called Tal Abyad from the ISIS terrorists mm-hmm. In June of 2015.
Yeah. Now, by the way, just apropos of Canada and its involvement. I remember interviewing Scott Taylor and yourself about this point, that Canada, when it goes to Iraq, tends to be involved mainly in the Kurdish areas, doesn't it?
Yes, of course. Of course. That's right. And that's problematic. Yes, and curious. because, you see, the thing is that right up to now, despite the fact that Prime Minister Trudeau had said that Canada was going to, withdraw from the bombing mission in Iraq, but it has not. It's still continuing, and it's still uncertain whether he's going to fulfill that promise. But at the same time, he has sent trainers to Iraq, to the Kurdish region. There are, I believe, at the present time, about 60 or 70 military trainers that are training these various groups, etc. And so, unfortunately, Canada is involved in the area, and it is not really very helpful to the overall situation over there.
Yeah, maybe they should say their Iraq Kurdish policy rather than Iraq. It would help us understand what they're up to.
Yes,
Zafar Benkash, crescent-online.org.
.net. Sorry.
.net.
Yes.
.net. Wonderful site, and I thank you very much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Bye bye. We'll be right back.
up next. Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jake Johnson of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the charges of rampant fraud and militant protests that led to the second cancellation of Haiti's scheduled presidential runoff election. Alex Felsen of the Urban Ecology and Design Lab at Yale University, who describes his work helping states adapt to severe weather events caused by climate change. And David Holtz of the Michigan chapter of the Sierra Club, who examines the causes and solutions to the ongoing water crisis in Flint, Michigan, where many in the city have been exposed to dangerous levels of lead. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a surge of global inequality, Oxfam reports 62 billionaires have amassed the same wealth as the poorest 3.6 billion people on the planet. The scale of inequality has exploded since 2010, with the wealth of top billionaires rising by $1.76 trillion, while the assets of the bottom half of humanity fell by 41%. Oxfam's report, titled An Economy for the 1%, was released on the eve of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, an annual gala of the super-rich and well-connected. Mark Goldring, CEO of Oxfam Great Britain, asserted, "World leaders' concerns about the escalating inequality crisis have so far not been translated into concrete action to ensure those at the bottom get their fair share of economic growth." Oxfam also blasted Conservative British Prime Minister David Cameron, who 3 years ago came to Davos to launch an initiative to stop massive tax avoidance by big corporations and the wealthy. Thus far, however, Cameron has done little to push for transparency in tax havens like the Cayman Islands. The Oxfam report estimates wealthy individuals have hidden over $7.6 trillion in overseas accounts. These funds could have generated over $190 billion in taxes to fund public services around the world. 50 Syrian refugees fleeing the brutal civil war in their country received a warm welcome in suburban Clarkston, Georgia, which has emerged as the Ellis Island of the American South in accepting over 60,000 refugees since the 1980s. Inside a community centre, the newly arrived Syrian refugees were greeted with a meal of Middle Eastern food, as Mayor Ted Terry praised the role of immigrants in American history. This stands in stark contrast to the views of Georgia's conservative Republican governor Nathan Deal, who, along with other GOP governors, has sought to halt the flow of Syrian refugees to their states after the ISIS terror attack in Paris. However, the federal government maintains legal jurisdiction over refugee resettlement. Clarkson, a working-class suburb of Atlanta, is among a handful of communities, including Dearborn, Michigan, and Portland, Maine, that have successfully resettled refugees from overseas conflicts. In Clarkson, which opened its doors to refugees in 1983, 4 out of 5 new immigrants have become economically self-sufficient within 6 months of arriving, with many launching new businesses and creating jobs. A RAND Corporation study found 90% of middle school students in the area around Compton, California, had witnessed at least one violent incident. Now, 8 students and teachers are suing the Compton Unified School District for failing to provide adequate resources and training to deal with trauma. New research has found that children and teenagers suffer long-lasting harmful effects after exposure to multiple acts of violence, leading to depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. Annie Hudson Price, an attorney representing the plaintiffs, told the news magazine In These Times, "Students have a legal right to access resources to deal with trauma and the right to an education. One of our plaintiffs," the attorney said, "was kicked out of every school in Compton. They are just being cycled through without getting the help they need." The plaintiffs are pressuring Compton to adopt an alternative approach used in Brockton, Massachusetts. 5 years ago, the working-class community located south of Boston adopted trauma-sensitive reforms in handing out discipline. Educators are urged to act proactively if they know a student was exposed to trauma such as domestic violence. The results, noted Brockton school official Sal Tarasi, are positive, with a decrease in suspensions and an improvement in attendance, resulting in students feeling a sense of belonging. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Under pressure from militant street protests triggered by charges of rampant fraud and a candidate boycott of Haiti's presidential runoff election, the government of unpopular President Michel Martelly canceled the scheduled January 24th vote. This, the second cancellation of the runoff election, comes amid uncertainty about the next steps in a chaotic electoral process. President Martelly's term in office officially ends on February 7th, and negotiations have begun to decide if an interim government would take power after Martelly's exit, or if he would remain in office until a replacement is elected. In the first round of the presidential election on October 25th, Martelly's hand-picked candidate, Jovenel Moïse, a political unknown, won 32.8% of the vote, with opposition candidate Jude Celestin winning 25.3% of ballots cast. Celestin announced he would not participate in the January 24th election due to the overt fraud and manipulation of the vote, a charge echoed by many Haitian and international observers. The second-place candidate said in a statement, quote, "Such utter contempt for the will of the Haitian people must end." Your reporter spoke with Jake Johnson, research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the charges of rampant fraud that led to the cancellation of the runoff election and the uncertain future of Haiti's electoral process.
There really had been a growing chorus from all sorts of civil society groups. You had religious leaders, human rights groups, and local observers. And really key among this group towards the end was also private sector groups that generally have been supportive of the president and really sort of had called for a pause to be taken and for this election to be delayed in order for a dialogue and a consensus to be reached in order to move forward. And also key amongst this is the role of the international community, of course. This is a $100 million electoral process, and the international community is funding the bulk of that, including the U.S., to the tune of over $30 million. And they were very much pressuring for this election to happen on schedule and on January 24th. And then at the last minute, as these negotiations broke down to try and reach some sort of a deal, sort of pulled the support for that election and started encouraging a dialogue before having the election. And that's really sort of what did in this electoral process on Sunday, and not just sort of the protest, which became the sort of pretext in order to blame the protest for causing this delay, which really was months in the making.
Now, the second place finisher in the previous election, presidential election, Jude Celestin, he declined to participate because of the fraud. What are the declarations being made by Jude Celestin in terms of the reasons why he did not want to participate in this election? And what conditions has he set up, if any, to participate in a future date for a runoff election?
Yeah, well, so key amongst the sort of, actions that have been taken over the last couple of months was an evaluation commission that was actually set up by the president himself. And this is the reason why the presidential election had first been delayed, was in order for this commission to perform its evaluation. And they did come back with a pretty, scathing report of the irregularities. In fact, they found only 8% of the tally sheets they looked at were totally free from any sort of irregularities. And that, in a number of cases, there were significant irregularities and that a number of people had been voting, these political party monitors, able to vote off lists, and that this made up a significant chunk of the voters. They outlined a number of steps to be taken to move forward, amongst them replacing the Electoral Council that had sort of been discredited throughout this process for its handling of the situation. It also called for sort of taking a further look at certain aspects of what had happened. Also, especially, as they pointed out, was retraining and rehiring all of the poll workers that were complicit in these irregularities or that were responsible for some of these actions that were carried out. You know, and what happened was directly after that report was issued, just a few days later, Martelly, by decree, invoked this election for the 24th. So without time to really implement or see how those changes could play out. And the implementation of those recommendations has sort of been the center point of what Celestin has been asking for, as well as many of the human rights groups and the business chambers as well have been asking for these recommendations to be implemented.
Jake, there have been demands for Martelly's removal from office, and I wondered if you would talk about the possible way forward should he leave the presidency or is succeeded by a provisional government when his term expires on February 7th.
Yes, that sort of remains the main sticking point in the negotiations currently for what happens next. There had been days of sort of negotiations about what this would look like. And then when it came down to it on Friday, things were really, this is again, 48 hours before the election was set to begin. It was still all set, apparently. And finally, when the Electoral Council called for the cancellation of the election, there was no date set sort of as part of a political agreement. And so, you know, the situation now is sort of back to the drawing books. And as all sides sort of approach the table and find a way forward. And I think that the question now is who is at that table and who's trying to sort of make that decision. Martelly has sort of indicated that he would like to be there to hand over, you know, the presidential sash to his successor, obviously sort of emboldened by the cancellation of the election. Some of the protesting groups are also calling for Martelly's immediate removal before the end of his term, which is February 7th. I think the most likely situation would be some sort of deal where Martelly leaves office at the end of his term on February 7th and as a consensus government is formed. And I think the question now is sort of what the makeup of that government might look like.
Jake, I wanted to get your view on why the Obama administration had supported going forward with elections until the 11th hour, elections where there would only really, in essence, be one candidate. And despite the widely held view from people on the ground there in Haiti and international human rights groups that the first round of balloting was rife with fraud. Why would the Obama administration want to go forward here?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And I think, you know, a lot of the political support behind Martelly for pushing this right to the edge and letting these tensions build over the previous months has been that support from the international community. I think when you look at it, there's a number of interests there. One is obviously as the funders of this election, they have, you know, a lot of interest in seeing it happen in an orderly manner. There also has been, you know, obviously billions of dollars invested in this country by the international community after the earthquake and really dating back to the 2004 coup after which the UN troops have been in Haiti. And so there's been a tremendous amount of money spent on trying to build up Haiti's institutions by the international community. And to see this process forward was supposed to be sort of a, you know, a culmination of this action. And this dates back also to the 2010 election where Martelly came to power, in which there was also, you know, many problems in the election. And it wasn't until actually Martelly's supporters took to the streets and the international community intervened that he was able to make it to the runoff and go to the elections. And in fact, the person who he displaced in that round then in 2010 was Jude Celestin, the man participating in the runoff this time. So I think you have to really go back and see these relationships develop and the roles of all the players to understand where the interest lies, certainly with the international community in the current process.
That was Jake Johnson, research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Learn more about Haiti's troubled electoral history and political instability by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As much of the East Coast was digging out from the historic snowstorm and coastal flooding that hit the region in late January, the federal government announced that it had awarded $1 billion to 14 states through the Department of Housing and Urban Development's National Disaster Resilience Competition. Connecticut, where 95% of the population lives within 50 miles of the coast and has suffered massive damage to its coastline in several recent storms, received roughly $54 million. Those funds will be spent developing a project in Bridgeport based on the state's resilience corridor concept, developing a regional planning effort for 13 municipalities in Fairfield and New Haven counties. The federal grant will also finance the development of a climate change adaptation framework through the Connecticut Institute for Resilience and Climate Adaptation at the University of Connecticut. Alex Felsen, a registered landscape architect for the past 15 years, worked closely with the University of Connecticut and state agencies on the HUD grant application. Through his own firm and the Urban Ecology and Design Lab at Yale, which he runs, he's focused on coastal adaptation, green infrastructure, and constructed ecosystems. He earlier won a $10 million grant to construct bioretention gardens at Seaside Village, a residential complex in coastal Bridgeport, Connecticut. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Felsen who describes how his work is helping the region adapt to severe weather events caused by climate change.
When you look at the risks that the state faces across these coastal areas, you know, there's some tremendous risks for Connecticut. It's second to Florida in terms of the amount of investment along the coast that's insured property. There's a lot of concern, especially with the Metro North and Highway 95 running parallel to the coast, with the functionality of the transportation infrastructure under future storm events and sea level rise. So what we developed was what we called a resilience corridor, which builds on transit-oriented development as a concept. So it's really an economic development proposal to connect resources and access upland to the shorefront communities or to the shorefront conditions. So rather than investing in repetitive flood loss housing along the shorefront or investing in directly in these neighborhoods, we're investing in the connecting corridors to these neighborhoods and looking at ways of using coastal adaptation funding as a tool to promote economic development, building on Metro North as a kind of connector across Connecticut.
Alex Felsen, are people in your field talking about moving people and infrastructure like railroad lines away from the immediate coast and abandoning it? I know after Superstorm Sandy, Governor Cuomo talked about buying up coastal properties and letting them go back to nature as a way of providing a storm buffer. Is that something that's going to be necessary in Connecticut or other regions? What's Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's take on this?
The governor talks about building up, not back. Connecticut has a unique condition in contrast to New Jersey or Florida or other locations. Florida and New Jersey, these are coastal plains, coastal Piedmonts, so they're fairly flat topographically. Connecticut is, because of the glacial landscape and the historic geology, was the basis of how the state formed over time. It creates these kind of ridge lines that run north-south and that have more of a patchy network of low-lying areas along the coast. And so the risks along the coasts are smaller patches. With some strategic reorganization and restructuring, as well as some effective kind of economic revitalization strategies in these corridors that create egress from areas at risk, the idea is to really reframe and value the land that we have and the housing stock that we have along the coast effectively for future conditions and to become, coastally adapted for the future. So it's pretty distinct from New Jersey or Florida and elsewhere in terms of the adaptation strategy that we're proposing. We're not really looking at retreat as an agenda. We're looking at economic revitalization as a tool to a structure relationships between the upland resources and upland connections and down to the shorefront communities.
Is there anything else you or people in your field are working on regarding coastal resilience?
There's all kinds of opportunities for rethinking or for establishing strategic phasing for how to adapt to future conditions. The challenge is that there's been a lot of build-out, a lot of infrastructure development and critical facilities built in coastal areas. And with homeowners and property ownership and private property, it creates a conundrum at the local scale for how to navigate and negotiate land use changes. That's where I think the value of landscape architecture and planning fields come in, where it's not just an infrastructure solution, but it's really an issue of communicating across the stakeholders and establishing solutions that are co-generated at a local level that can promote or allow for adaptation over time, but that can also use the funding towards ecological benefits and social benefits. So in Connecticut, the idea of the resilience corridor, while it functions as an egress to help alleviate some of the risk within each municipality, it also allows for access to the coast, which is one of the issues that we have in Connecticut, is that we have limited access to the coast. So it strategically adds a social value while also creating risk reduction. And I think that idea of multifunctional landscapes and developing these ecologically rich and socially rich solutions are the way to move this forward.
That was Alex Felsen, a landscape architect, assistant professor at Yale University, and head of Yale's Urban Ecology Design Lab. For more information on Felsen's work and climate change adaptation, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan, has in recent weeks attracted widespread media attention, with a focus on the reckless actions of Michigan Republican Governor Rick Snyder's administration. The governor's appointment of an emergency manager in Flint, nullifying the city's democratic governance, began a chain of events that led to the municipality switching water sources from Detroit's public water system to the Flint River in April 2014. The water from the river corroded the city's pipes and contaminated the water supply with dangerous levels of lead, impacting Flint's mostly poor and black population of 100,000. Lead poisoning can produce lifelong health effects, especially in children. That includes brain damage, learning disabilities, and behavioral problems. Although Governor Snyder recently apologized for his administration's mistakes that resulted in Flint's water disaster, his attorney general's appointment of a special counsel to determine if state laws were broken was later revealed to be a donor to both the governor and attorney general's 2010 and 2014 election campaigns, which did not instill confidence in the credibility of the investigation. Local and state government were not alone in their culpability in Flint's water crisis. Susan Hedman, administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency region responsible for Michigan, has resigned effective February 1st due to charges that she hadn't done enough to prevent the lead contamination of Flint's water. Your reporter spoke with David Holtz, executive committee chair of the Michigan chapter of the Sierra Club, who examines the causes and solutions to the ongoing water crisis in Flint, as well as the role of environmental racism in the disaster.
People almost immediately after the switch to the Flint River noticed that there was something wrong with their water. They weren't scientists, but it tasted funny. It looked funny. It was brown, discolored. And then they would take these complaints to, like you would expect in any community, to their, you know, local public officials. But unlike in any other community, the local public officials had no power to do anything about it. So it was this sort of echo chamber of people complaining. The state, through their public relations people at the state agency in charge of drinking water, dismissed them as kind of being troublemakers and really downplayed the whole thing. And meanwhile, within the government process, we had this very interesting and tragic tension going on where drinking water experts inside the state government, who were the regulators, were not treating the water according to law, the legal requirements. They were testing and monitoring outside the protocols that are required under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And all of this sort of came to the attention of a few people just about kind of at the same time. One was Mark Edwards, who was a drinking water expert from Virginia Tech. And he got basically a call from a woman in Flint and said, I think my water is, there's something wrong with my water. And he took her through the process of testing the water, found lead levels that he said were in 25 years of his experience as an expert in water, drinking water, he had never seen anything close to the lead levels that were coming out of the faucet in this woman's home. So he immediately began using his own money to recruit people to do testing in Flint. And they came up with a series of samples and using the EPA protocols, and it clearly showed that there was a lead contamination problem. And still inside the state agency, drinking water agency, they were discounting, downplaying, dismissing, and reassuring people publicly that nothing was wrong with their water.
David, tell us what role you think environmental racism may have played in the various missteps that were made here by local and state government.
I cannot imagine that if a community, say Grosse Pointe, which is a wealthy suburban Detroit community, or Bloomfield Hills, which is in one of the wealthier counties in America, in Michigan, if there was lead contamination, or if they were switching their water source and needed corrosion controls, that someone in state government would have said, for instance, well, we're going to save $150 a day by not treating the water, so let's not treat the water. You know, it's really unimaginable that would have happened in a white, wealthy community in America. And, you know, communities like Flint, and there are other, you know, there is a pattern in practice in Michigan in the last, say, 6, 7, 8 years, where whenever there is a choice between protecting public health, whether it's water or air, or saving money or delivering a benefit for a wealthy corporation, the choice seems often, if not always, to err on the side of, you know, not protecting the public when it comes to community of color.
David, as we conclude here, what are the steps you think it will take to have a resolution, a safe resolution to the water crisis in Flint? How much money is going to be needed? How much reconstruction of the infrastructure in Flint has to be done?
You know, the best answer to that question really is that the EPA has issued an emergency order where it's beginning to assume control over the Flint water monitoring and is attempting to hold the state to the requirements of the law. And the requirements of the law are pretty, you know, the lead and copper rule has very specific rules about what you do in situations like that. And the rules, first of all, require a level of monitoring that hasn't gone on, so you know the scope of the problem. When you understand that the problem has triggered more than 10% or more contamination of the drinking water supply, and it's related to lead and lead pipes, you have are then required to begin replacing those pipes. That, I think, is sort of the path toward, you know, addressing the situation in Flint. And the costs, the estimates have ranged from $80 million to $1.2 billion to replace the entire lead infrastructure in Flint of water pipes. This is something that, in my view, requires the equivalent of a Marshall Plan for this community, that we need to set aside the ideology that caused this problem and go out and bond to the amount of money that it's going to take to solve the problem and solve the problem and get it moving. This has been the frustration with the Snyder administration in Michigan is that we have not seen the urgency meet the demands of this crisis yet.
That was David Holtz, Executive Committee Chair of the Michigan Chapter of the Sierra Club. For more perspectives on the events leading up to Flint's water crisis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Flint. Water wars against the poor. If ever one wondered about the efficacy of a state government imposing officials on local government, Flint, Michigan has answered that question forever. In April 2014, the state-appointed emergency manager, in order to save money, ordered that the city's water source be changed from Lake Huron to the notoriously polluted Flint River. The switch unleashed a citywide disaster of disease, destruction, and death. Flint was a toxic river, rich in lead, a major pollutant that has devastating effects on brain development, speech, and IQ levels, especially in children. As soon as it was pumped out into municipal water systems, the waters leached lead from the old pipes and sped it to some 99,000 homes in the city. Flint is now a poisoned city because of its toxic water. It also illustrates how officials from afar can cause a catastrophe at home. Now, tens of thousands of children who drank the water and were bathed in the water may suffer lifelong problems, skin diseases, cognitive impairment, speech deficits, and more. The state, being penny wise and pound foolish, has created a problem that may last for generations. The state's emergency manager created an emergency. The Michigan example of the politics of austerity will cause problems that will cost billions of dollars to resolve, if ever. The politics of ignoring the problems of the poor erupt like lava, demanding national attention. Michigan, by the way, is named after the Chippewa words, Michigamma, meaning great water. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder will be remembered not for great water, but for toxic water. For Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
American Indian Movement AIM activist Leonard Peltier has been in the clutches of the U.S. prison system, the Iron House of the Whites, as indigenous people call them, on trumped-up murder charges. Now, as he suffers poor health and an abdominal aortic aneurysm, time is no longer on his side. The aneurysm, diagnosed just weeks ago, threatens his very life, so supporters of Leonard are demanding his freedom, so he doesn't perish in the Iron House. Decades ago, when Bill Clinton was president, he visited Pine Ridge, South Dakota, once Peltier's home, and told people there, "Tell Leonard I won't forget about him." A promise from Clinton proved as empty as any politician's promise. Gas, air, wind. Well, he must have forgot, huh? So Peltier languished in the Iron House as decades passed. He wrote, he painted, and he awaited white justice. He's still waiting. His supporters want people to write to the BOP demanding his health care and release. The International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee needs you to write and call on Leonard's behalf.
contact www.bop.gov/inmates/concerns.jsp. Refer to Leonard Peltier, number 89637-132, and his home jail, USP Coleman 1. And now that I think about it, why don't you write to the White House and demand executive clemency? Leonard Peltier needs freedom now, and Native peoples need him to return home. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. She is remembered for rocking an outrageous afro, her fist raised in naked defiance of the system. For many years, she taught at UCAL Santa Cruz and worked in the prison abolition and social justice movements. Now, today, thanks to Haymarket Books, you can read her recent speeches and interviews, speeches that address the Black Lives Matter movement, the failure of black politics, and gender struggles that are bubbling up from below. It is vintage Angela, insightful, curious, observant, and brilliant, asking and answering questions about events in this new century that look surprisingly similar to the last century. The new book, hot off the presses, is Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement. The title draws on a heartbreaking dirge from a Negro spiritual sung many, many years ago in her native South, the long, unrelenting struggle for freedom, one that still animates her. The title also reminds us of former Black Panther Kilu Niasha, who hosts a show on public radio by the same name. At times, history lesson, political education, world studies, and gender theories, Angela Y. Davis gives us all a lot to ponder. It is a slim volume, 158 pages, but well worth the read. So check out Freedom is a Constant Struggle at haymarketbooks.org by Angela Y. Davis. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. war against white men. Several days ago, while viewing the weekly Sunday CNN show hosted by Fareed Zakaria, I saw a segment documenting the rising death tolls of white men, especially between the ages of 45 and 54 years. The causes were various: drug overdoses, car accidents, alcoholism, and suicides. Of course, some of the other causes, such as drugs or even car accidents, are actually hidden suicides sometimes. All other groups showed declines. I found it intriguing, especially when class and education were factored in, working class and high school diplomas or less. I've since read half a dozen articles, some scientific, others journalistic, from a variety of publications, many speculating, as big a variety of speculations on causes: failing health, low wages, fear of a changing, browning America, etc. Yet none of these articles touched on what initially came to mind. I'll call it the NAFTA effect for the North American Free Trade Agreement, which sent millions of manufacturing jobs across the border and U.S. businesses in search of cheaper labor. For me, this reason seemed obvious, especially since NAFTA was so widely known, for it affected jobs on both sides of the border, forcing wages lower and lower. An owner, for example, faced with union demands for higher wages, might easily threaten to go overseas to frighten labor leaders into concessions, even givebacks. NAFTA, the gift of Clinton I, was an executive betrayal of labor who fought for and funded the presidential campaign of William Jefferson Clinton. He betrayed them by making a sweet deal with the business class. It ain't the only factor, but I'm convinced it is a factor. Americans, once again, voting for their own betrayers. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you. What specific techniques have been employed by the FBI and its predecessors to undermine groups, from labor organizers in the late 19th century to the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement in the late 1960s? What were the circumstances that led to the standoff between federal agents and AIM at Wounded Knee more than 40 years ago? Why was Leonard Peltier implicated in the deaths of the two FBI agents, and why does he remain in custody? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we complete our trilogy of stories focusing on American political prisoners by speaking with well-known academic, author, and American Indian Movement member Ward Churchill. On this week's program, COINTELPRO, Leonard Peltier and the Limits of Resistance, Conversation with Ward Churchill. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 5th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory and on the homeland of the Métis people. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The World Health Organization declared the Zika virus a global health emergency on Monday, February 1st, without providing much detail on the disease. This sexually transmitted virus has been around for 69 years and is marketed by two companies, LGC Standards, headquartered in the UK, and ATCC, headquartered in the US. And who owns the patent on the virus? The Rockefeller Foundation. Why has the issue of patent ownership of the Zika virus not been the object of media coverage? That comes from the article, Who Owns the Zika Virus? By Guillaume Cress, posted February 3rd. The U.S. falsely blamed Iraq for playing a role in the 9/11 attacks, as shown by a memo from the Defense Secretary, as one of the main justifications for launching the Iraq War. Top U.S. government officials now admit that the Iraq War was really launched for oil, not 9/11 or weapons of mass destruction. Despite previous lone wolf claims, many U.S. government officials now say that 9/11 was state-sponsored terror, but Iraq was not the state which backed the hijackers. Many U.S. officials have alleged that 9/11 was a false flag operation by rogue elements of the U.S. government, but such a claim is beyond the scope of this discussion. The key point is that the U.S. falsely blamed it on Iraq when it knew Iraq had nothing to do with it. That comes from the article, 58 Admitted False Flag Attacks, by Washington's blog, posted February 3rd. PricewaterhouseCoopers recently published the results of a survey that collected the opinions of 1,409 CEOs of 83 countries on the economic panorama. 66% of those interviewed considered that their corporate organizations face greater threats today than 3 years ago, and only 27% think that global growth will improve. The uncertainty is such that during the Davos summit, there was no consensus among business giants as to when the next crisis will hit. With this, the Western press did not hesitate to point out that the deceleration of China is the principal cause of the turbulence in the world economy. In fact, George Soros, who hit the pound sterling in the 1990s, maintained in Davos that a violent landing of the Chinese economy is inevitable, without doubt, an exaggerated affirmation. In my judgment, there is a propaganda campaign against Beijing that attempts to hide the serious economic and social contradictions that persist in the industrialized countries, the United States, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, Japan, etc. That comes from the article, Where Will the Next Global Economic Crisis Explode? Colossal Stock Market Losses in 2016, by Ariel Noyola Rodriguez, posted February 3rd, originally appearing in Spanish on Russia Today. So implementing a ceasefire is the UN's top priority, as it is Washington's. But why would Putin agree to a ceasefire now, just when the Russian-led coalition is making great strides on the battlefield, the war's momentum has shifted in his favor, and the jihadist militias appear to be on the ropes? He probably won't agree to a ceasefire, nor will he agree to have Assad be removed by force of arms, but he might be willing to ease up on his current military offensive and even allow the U.S. to retain captured territory in eastern Syria that could be used for future pipeline corridors, if he thought that Russia would benefit from the deal. What if the Saudis, acting on behalf of their friends in Washington, offered to cut back production so prices began to rise and Russia's economy started to rebound? That comes from the article, Oil Price Treachery. Are the Saudis blackmailing Putin for concessions on Syria? By Mike Whitney, posted February 3rd, originally appearing at Counterpunch. On November 16, 2015, F. William Engdahl headlined, Do We Really Want a New World War with Russia? And he itemized the ways in which Russia's military performance in both Ukraine and Syria has shocked the U.S. and its allies, especially any U.S. president who would continue the effort started in 1990 by President George Herbert Walker Bush to conquer and grab control of the resources of post-communist Russia is insane, especially now after the February 2014 U.S.-run coup in Ukraine crossed the line that Russia had repeatedly warned must not be crossed. If this effort ever stops, the news media won't report the U.S. gang's retreat from this by now 25-year-long war against Russia, which those same news media have consistently refused to report. But even if they were to report it, no obligation by the West is so important as the obligation to stop it. The obligation to call off the West's Saudi, Qatari, Turkish, UAE, Kuwaiti finance, Sunni terrorists, and the rest of the West's, via NATO, the IMF, etc., war against Russia and against Russia's Shiite and BRICS allies. That comes from the article, How Corruption Cripples America's Military, U.S. versus Russian Weaponry, Who Wins? By Eric Zeus, posted February 3rd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Saturday, February 6th, marks Leonard Peltier's 40th year in prison. He's been serving two consecutive life sentences for the first-degree murders of two federal agents during a famous firefight which took place on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. Peltier's incarceration is widely perceived as unjust as well as politically motivated, given his alliance with the American Indian Movement at a time when that organization posed a challenge to U.S. federal authorities. One man who's familiar with this case is Ward Churchill. He's written and spoken extensively on not only Peltier, but on the way the Federal Bureau of Investigation has contained popular struggles against colonial power. Ward Churchill served as professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder from 1990 until 2007. His work focuses on the U.S. government's historical treatment of political dissenters and resistors. Ward Churchill has long been affiliated with the American Indian Movement of Colorado and was a resident of the Northern Plains, Colorado region before moving to Atlanta in 2013, where he continues his writing and research. He has authored several books, including 1988's agents of repression, the FBI's secret wars against the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, with Jim Vanderwall from South End Press. 1990s, the COINTELPRO papers, documents from the FBI's secret war against domestic dissent, again with Jim Vanderwall, also from South End Press. And 2003's On the Justice of Roosting Chickens, reflections on the consequences of U.S. imperial arrogance and criminality, from AK Press. I had a chance recently to interview Ward Churchill. During our conversation, we explored the history of U.S. state counterinsurgency warfare, the so-called COINTELPRO program, American Indian Movement involvement in the Pine Ridge Oglala Nation region in what is called South Dakota, and the famous case of Leonard Peltier. Here is that conversation. I wanted to help provide us some historical context, because as I understand it, this has been an evolution of already existing practices within the FBI going back to the early 20th century, which cracked down on groups like the Industrial Workers of the World and the communists.
Well, actually, it goes back even further than the early 20th century. You find the origins of this. I don't want to take it too far, because you can find the actual origins in France and so on, the early part of the 19th century. But it emerges, the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which is the precursor of the FBI, after the so-called Civil War down here. Pinkerton Detective Agency was the entity that was retained by the newly formed Justice Department of the United States to perform investigative work with regard to violation of federal law, ostensibly at least. But quite a lot of that activity, Pinkerton activity, went to enforcing the status quo, moneyed interests and so forth, in a manner consistent with what federal government wanted to see accomplished, that is, to do with developing the railroad net in this country and development of heavy industry and so forth. Went to attacking the labor movement, went to keeping the racial status quo in effect and so forth. And a lot of the techniques that were used with regard to the Molly Maguires in the Pennsylvania coal fields, for example, these were the pioneering techniques of political repression that were perfected in concert with the federal government and various state governments and major corporate interests. Infiltration of agents provocateurs, that is, people who are infiltrated to engage, propose whatever criminal activity that could be used into mount ostensibly non-political criminal charges against particularly select key activists and so forth, political assassination, either de facto or de jure, de facto by extra legal use of the criminal justice system to accomplish neutralization, as it becomes known, of key activists and sometimes massive repression of rank-and-file membership, but also de jure, which is to say literally using state forces, often in clandestine fashion, to effect outright assassinations of targeted activists. Disinformation campaigns, which come to do with the issuance of black and gray propaganda. Black propaganda often attributed falsely to political activists themselves. Gray propaganda having to do with essentially what we would now call spin, to affect a general popular discrediting of political movements, orchestration of false charges in the judicial system, political imprisonment. They've literally had facilities that were designated pretty much continuously since the late part of the 19th century to hold political activists. activists in the sense we ordinarily understand them, but also activists in the sense the status quo understands them, which has to do with the rank-and-file union membership, for example. The membership of political organizations and so on could be consigned to special facilities. They constructed camps in Idaho to basically round up United Mine Workers membership or Western Federation of Mine Workers or Miners membership en masse. You had that occur also in Arizona. Now, these are nominally private entities, these detective agencies, and Pinkerton was the most prominent, but you had Burns Detective Agency and a number of others that came into being because there was great demand for the sort of operative service to orchestrate the disruption and to gather intelligence. Pinkerton was right clear about the key to all politically repressive efforts, maintaining order, as they called it, had to do with knowing what was going on and who was in the process of doing it at all times. And so you had this nationwide informant net that was concocted, created. People who were nominally members of activist organizations, people who would provide information based upon political disagreements, competitiveness, petty jealousies. They worked on all of this and still do. Because so, what you're seeing emerge out of the Pinkertons, which is that entity was replaced as the investigative agency, as you say, in the early part of the 20th century by what was initially simply called the Bureau of Investigation. It doesn't become the Federal Bureau of Investigation until the 1930s.
But, well, just in terms of these...
Those techniques form the template for what becomes COINTELPRO ultimately. But you have the repression of the labor movement, particularly immigrants, in the early part of the 20th century. The anarchist movement was especially targeted, and the IWW stuff ties to that with the so-called Palmer raids, nationwide raids on immigrant labor halls and so forth that occurred in 1919-1920, nationwide mass deportations and mass incarcerations and the targeting of the Communist Party and the Communist Workers' Party, or Communist Labor Party, excuse me, came right out of that in the 1920s. Supposedly, there's a period after the Palmer raids because they were so visible at the time, so draconian in their approach that the liberal establishment was appalled and they put an end to it. And J. Edgar Hoover, the famous FBI director for life, was installed on the basis of a promise that the FBI would be, or the Bureau of Investigation, as it was known at the time, would no longer engage in political surveillance and repression activities, but never stopped. It never stopped.
That whole idea
continued through the 1920s and really took off again in the 1930s.
So when we come to the era in the 1960s and the emergence of COINTELPRO, in what ways was that distinct from the previous efforts? Was it merely a refinement of previous methods?
Or? Yeah, it's a centralization and rendering it more systematic. COINTELPRO, you know, that's an acronym, or more properly, you might put it as a cryptonym because it was a secret program during its formal duration. Simply means counterintelligence program. Now, what's different about this innocuous-sounding counterintelligence program captioned COINTELPRO is that it is specifically focused on domestic business. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're targeting agents of foreign powers, the standard constitutional protections and so forth do not apply, all right? That's as a matter of law. You can do things to neutralize a Soviet spy or a German spy earlier on, and so forth that you cannot do to a U.S. citizen. the point of a counterintelligence operation is, and I'm paraphrasing an FBI official explaining it, is to neutralize the target by whatever means. You can do that by killing them. You can do that by exposing them. You can do that by discrediting them. You can do that by what's called badjacking them, convincing their intelligence agency that they become double agents and they may be liquidated then by their own organization, and so on and so on and so on. Now, none of these are legal in the context of constitutional protections in the United States, but given essentially war, the context of war, these are enemy agents that are not U.S. citizens.
So neutralizing
invoke all these techniques. They created a rationalization. This is what the secret program to systematically utilize these techniques, these counterintelligence techniques against U.S. dissidents, U.S. citizens. It's not counterintelligence. It's counter-subversion. And at a certain point, in their own documents, it becomes counterinsurgency because they're referring to targets, particularly in the American Indian movement, not in terms of being radicals or political extremists, but in terms of being insurgents.
Well,
if you're going after insurgents, combat insurgents, it's by definition counterinsurgency. This is a technique of war. So war was mounted against American Indian movement, but arguably, although that particular vernacular was not employed against the Black Panther Party and other political organizations in the late 1960s, early 1970s, on, I would argue, right on through to today.
Mm. So you were just mentioning the Black Panther Party, and that seemed to be one of the most dynamic threats to the establishment. And so I guess I don't know if you want to say some words about how that the success that the COINTELPRO program had in undermining that efforts. I mean, if there's just maybe a couple of a couple of the main features of that crackdown that appears to have done them in.
Well, it's not a crackdown, okay? They're not cracking down on criminal activity. They're criminalizing. They're misrepresenting, often using their own operatives that have been infiltrated in the organization to make statements that they could record, then print in the press in order to misrepresent the positions and policies of the organization targeted, in this case, the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party was actually a lawful organization, you see. The problem was it was a black organization, and so when they availed themselves of this revered Second Amendment right of American citizens to bear arms in public, okay, and to defend themselves against unwarranted aggression and all the rest of that. Well, this is black folk with guns. This is unacceptable. They actually start in California where this begins. They changed the law to delegitimate what had always been perfectly legitimate practice simply because it was black people doing it. And if you look at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, it had a self-determining component to it, obviously, but primarily was based on, hey, equal rights under the law and community self-sufficiency and all these good things that the status quo is always saying it wants black people to do when they were actually doing it.
Yeah, it does seem strange to me.
On that basis, J. Edgar Hoover proclaimed the Black Panther Party to be the number one internal security threat to the United States. That's all 5,000-odd black members of the Black Panther Party. Now, the preeminent internal security threat to the United States is an inner-city-based organization of 5,000 members, then there is no particular internal security threat to the United States, except that the message of the Panthers was, you know, if you've got an equitable situation, you change it by taking charge of your own affairs. do for yourself. Organize the community, the resources of the community to meet community needs, and do not be dependent upon those who are oppressing you to fulfill them.
Is that what the real threat of the party was, that they were actually setting up things like, you know, feeding people and education and all of that, rather than the gun aspect that, you know, the NRA should conceivably be in full sympathy with?
Well, they had a problem with the guns because that created a certain parity with the police, at least symbolically. And that won't do, because blacks are to be subjugated, okay? They're to be intimidated, cowed into accepting things that are absolutely unacceptable because the alternatives were even worse. And when you say you got a right to defend yourself, including from a cop who is violating your rights, which is, there's all kinds of judicial precedent on that in the United States. You know, that changes the calculus. It changed the calculus of police violence directed against the black community in Oakland dramatically in a single year. The Panther Street Patrols, well, that's the antithesis of what those in charge want to see happen. And so, yeah, a whole lot of propaganda was made in the basis of the armed component of the Panther program, but it was a self-defense, and articulated such self-defense posture, not an aggressive posture, mm-hmm. not an attack of the police. It's defend yourself when the police attack you. You see, big difference. They always talk about the violence-prone Panthers, but it was the Panthers who were getting shot, so I don't know what their violence propensity was. What, attacking police bullets with their chests? Mm-hmm. You got 30-odd dead Panthers pretty much before you ever see,
of course,
any casualties on the other side. So even when it becomes firefights, straight-up firefights between the Panthers and the police, the Panthers are defending themselves against attack. But yes, in answer to your earlier question, the Breakfast for Children program that you mentioned in particular was named number one priority for destruction by Hoover himself. The idea that the blacks could organize in a manner which would render their oppressed communities self-sufficient was absolutely to be halted, because they wouldn't then not be in this subjugated posture. And what that is a defense of the key word, order. You know, there's that spoke cliche about, it comes out of the anal compulsion of German households for orderliness. There's a place for everything, and everything's in its place. Well, this is the social corollary. There's a place for everyone, and everyone is to remain in their place. And you can see the place assigned to black folk. You can see the place assigned for the Mexican population north of the Rio Bravo. You can see the place to which Asian immigrants were assigned, and you can certainly see the place to which American Indians were assigned in the racial hierarchy, the structure of white supremacism in the United States then and now.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Pine Ridge Reservation is located in what is known as South Dakota at the border with Nebraska. U.S. surveyors had strategic interest in the territory owing to the rich uranium and molybdenum deposits situated there. However, in order to gain control of those deposits, the federal government would be legally required to forge a deal with the reservation's tribal government. The Lakota people were by and large hostile to any deals that would see more of their territory yielded to the feds. As a result, U.S. federal authorities arranged to have a local stooge named Dickie Wilson take charge. Ward Churchill described Wilson as a plumber and bootlegger. With the resources he received from outside, Wilson was able to secure a powerful base in the community. However, the nepotism and other corrupt practices he allegedly embraced proved too much for other community members to endure, so an opposition formed, calling itself the Oglala Sioux Civil Rights Organization, or OSCRO, and orchestrated an impeachment process. Wilson was able to defend himself by financing a kind of paramilitary called the Guardians of Oglala Nation, or Goons, which reported directly to him and was set up to intimidate the opposition. Or Churchill explained what happened next and how Leonard Peltier and the American Indian Movement got involved in the community.
At that point, they began to fund Wilson with basically highway funds to establish what was initially called the Tribal Rangers Group, becomes known as the Goon Squads, quite appropriately. Wilson's Goons, which is a paramilitary force, and they were trying to intimidate the OSCRO people. They were getting serious resistance to that. You had a spike in violence occurring on Pine Ridge. They sent in this 60-man special operations group of federal marshals, as they called it, in baby blue jumpsuits to set up machine gun positions and right on top of the tribal building sandbag positions. And you had these guys patrolling with basically military hardware to maintain order during the impeachment. Okay. In effect, Wilson was then named to preside over his own impeachment hearing, and he sent out tribal police, which was heavily overlapped with this goon squad that we're talking about. Two-thirds of the tribal police are known members of the goon squad by the time this is done. Arrested the tribal council members who were opposed to him, so that only his own guys were sitting at the impeachment hearing over that he has his own. He basically named the chair himself and then told the chair what to say, and began the impeachment by running a short film put out by the John Birch Society called Anarchy USA, basically saying his oppositions wanted to instill anarchy as a condition of life on the reservation, and it was his explanation of why he had to be retained. And then, you know, everybody voted. Everybody that was not in a jail cell, which were all of his own appointees or his surrogates, basically. And so I think there were four people voted. That's all of the tribal council that was actually there, but whatever it was, the report was he was unanimously continued in office. And he immediately then came out and issued a ban, a public statement, issued a ban on meetings, political meetings on Pine Ridge Reservation. Well, that's when the old people called for American Indian Movement to come to Pine Ridge. In effect, American Indian Movement and the Oglala Resistance went to Wounded Knee to convene a glorified press conference and were immediately surrounded by Wilson's goons. And shortly after the goons had established their roadblocks, the marshals were setting up roadblocks in conjunction with that, and then the FBI showed up, and then the Army advisors were sent from the White House, and there you have it. So you have this 71-day siege that's always called the Occupation of Wounded Knee. Well, they didn't go there to occupy the place, you know, other than temporarily, as I say, for purposes of attracting media attention, getting the message out of what was happening on Pine Ridge. But they certainly got media attention on the basis of this 71-day siege when you've got armored personnel carriers provided by to the federal authorities by the South Dakota National Guard, and you've got machine guns on full display, and you've got 500,000 rounds of gunfire exchanged, and you've got one marshal, one FBI guy hit, two Indians killed, about 20 people seriously wounded. So you got a lot of media play, a lot of public attention.
Interesting.
But then you've also got a specialist in political repression, a guy by the name of Richard G. Held. Richard Held is instrumental in setting up the counterinsurgency operation that occurs in Pine Ridge in the aftermath of Wounded Knee. This is basically the method that was being used by the CIA in Latin America at the time, that they would enlist the local police forces and components of the military and so forth,
mm-hmm.
forming death squads, and that's exactly what they were called in Latin America. Those who were the strong traditionals were requesting in many cases, and this is true with regard to the Peltier case at the Jumping Bull property outside Oglala, they had requested, they'd been harassed by the goons, they felt threatened. These are old people, Harry and Cecilia, Jumping Bull. They requested the security be provided by American Indian Movement and the Northwest AIM Group, which is Leonard Peltier, Bob Robidoux, Dino Butler in particular, but it's a somewhat larger group than that.
Mm-hmm.
Provided they set up a camp down by Cottonwood Creek to secure the property and to protect these old people and the younger members of the family as well from goon violence. And so that was taken as a target. The FBI basically had made the decision that we will break the back of the American Indian Movement and the Oglala Resistance right here, right now. You know, we thought they would have given up long before this, but they haven't. So we need to really have a major incident that can justify the introduction of overwhelming force. Well, they got that with the Oglala firefight. They got two dead agents.
Essentially a public relations exercise.
Firefight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two dead FBI agents, that makes headlines. And they hyped it beyond belief that it was, they were lured into an ambush. Well, there was no ambush. And they were fired on with automatic weapons from fixed positions once they'd been lured into the kill zone. There were no fixed positions and there were no automatic weapons. You even had a report come out of there within about 24 hours that the agents had been scalped. None of which was true, and the FBI knew it because immediately after the firefight, they had control of the ground. Okay? They had the bodies. They knew there were no fixed positions. There was no indication, and they knew that because the firefight went on for a considerable period of time. They were taking no automatic weapons fire. And on and on and on. When Tom Cole was the FBI spokesman who convened the press conference and put out the disinformation to make the headlines to justify what they were going to do next, he flat lied about all of it, and he knew that he was lying. Okay. He knew you could make, if you want to be an apologist for the FBI, you can say that FBI Director Clarence Kelly, when he repeated the same stuff in L.A. a day after that. He may not have known the details because he was not there, but Tom Cole and the agents who were on the scene definitely did know. Okay, so disinformation was put out about that.
Mm-hmm. And
there was an Indian man killed that day, too, by the name of Joe Stuntz. Unmentioned, they put together what they call resmurs investigation, reservation murders. Well, they weren't investigating all these murders that we've been talking about. They're investigating only the deaths of the two agents, and not even Joe Stuntz, who was killed at the same time. Yeah, and what they wanted to do was target people who were clearly committed AIM members and from off the reservation if they could. There were a lot of locals who were in a Jumping Bull camp, were on the Jumping Bull property that day, who were involved in the firefight. This was known to the FBI, too. They targeted for charges only members of the Northwest AIM group. So they're trying to divide the locals from the non-locals, divide the Indians, even the resistant Indians, against one another.
Yeah.
The us versus them. So you're getting local people who they don't know what to do in the condition. They want to protect their local boys. And so, well, you got these dead agents, and that clearly happened in 250-odd militarily equipped FBI agents pouring onto that reservation within 48 hours they were in place. You know, the overwhelming force aspect is in effect. So the locals, when queried often, are saying, well, it was those outside guys who did it, and they're trying to protect the, you know, basically their nieces, nephews, sons, daughters, whatever. So it was a very effective tactic.
Leonard Peltier had fled to Canada shortly after the incident. He was arrested and extradited to the U.S. based on fabricated evidence, including an affidavit from what he described as a psychologically compromised woman named Myrtle Poorbear. As she herself would later attest, Myrtle was made to fabricate a story about how she was Leonard's girlfriend and that she had heard him talk about how he had orchestrated to murder the two agents. While these proceedings were taking place, two other AIM members were also implicated in the deaths of the two FBI agents and were being tried for the crime in Peltier's absence.
Meanwhile, they had captured Butler and Robidoux separately, one in Kansas, one in South Dakota. And they had two of the three, so they went to trial in Cedar Rapids. Okay, and the charges against them are the same charges against Leonard Peltier. They're, in effect, his co-defendants. But they're being prosecuted first because they're available for prosecution, and the feds want to get some motion on this while Peltier's still sitting in Ocala, and you got this indefinite period before he's going to be coming back. Okay? Now, they presented the argument about this being a conspiracy and to lure the agents into the trial, all the rest of it. But you had a judge there that allowed considerable latitude in the development of a self-defense argument. Nobody said. Bob and Dino, neither of them said that they did not participate. In fact, Bob, to all intents and purposes, said, I killed them both. Okay? Mm-hmm. Both were mortally wounded by large bore, 44 caliber, in fact. That's a pretty big weapon. He said, I was the only one using a 44 Magnum during a firefight. Another guy had it. He was a lousy shot, and I'm not, so I took it away from him, and I used that. Bob said, I did. I was the one, in effect, who killed him, and I would do it again because of the way the FBI was comporting itself. And you had the defense called people from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission who had investigated what was happening on Pine Ridge and the FBI director himself. All upshot was the jury determined that under the conditions that had been created by the FBI, it was the only reasonable course of action to defend themselves against the attack. And they were acquitted on the basis of having acted in self-defense reasonably. So this leaves Leonard Peltier as the only possible conviction. And if you look at Peltier's case, once they got him back down here, that whole conspiracy notion had gone away. And he was prosecuted on the basis of being lone gunman.
Yeah.
Well, I would submit to you that it's at least plausible. I don't believe it's true in either instance, but it's at least plausible that the federal prosecutors believed that there was a conspiracy. Or they believed there was a lone gunman. But they presented both cases, and they couldn't possibly have believed both.
Mm.
So you had this knowing tailoring of the facts in one or both cases. I would argue in both cases. And they were not successful the first time, and they really went about tailoring things. They went judge shopping, and they had the entire trial record from Cedar Rapids declared inadmissible as evidence in court again during the trial against Peltier, so that agents, for example, J. Gary Adams, who was present at on site at the time, he was the first agent that tried to go in after the firefight had begun, and he took fire and retreated and hid in a ditch until it was all over. And felt guilty about it, apparently, because these were his two friends that were getting killed while he hid in a ditch. Okay, he testified to one set of facts at Cedar Rapids a completely different set of facts of what he had observed against Peltier, and the defense was disallowed by the judge from impeaching his testimony based upon his prior testimony. You see how this worked. Completely different case, the same set of facts presented against Peltier would have been unsuccessful in Cedar Rapids against Butler and Robidoux. So that was a railroad job from start to finish. Yeah. And you've had jurors have said since, if we had been aware of this at the time, we would have voted the opposite. You see, so they had a very cooperative judge, you could say, Paul Benson, that resulted in Peltier's conviction.
And yet, we've seen over the years
the evidence that was presented, the physical evidence is absurd, and even the Eighth Circuit Court has arrived at that conclusion. Mm. And I can't remember, and the last appeal that went to the Eighth Circuit Court, the three-judge panel, this is in the mid-'80s, 1985, I believe, three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit Court that heard Peltier's appeal, headed by William Webster, who wasn't even there to issue the opinion because he'd already become appointed director of the FBI. So he handled the appeal, despite knowing he now had this inherent conflict of interest, big-time conflict of interest. You know, Judge Haney, who read out the opinions that, you know, the record demonstrates significant misconduct on the part of the FBI. But to remand this for a retrial would impute even further misconduct, and this we're reluctant to do. Which is the same as saying if this was any ordinary case, this would have, the verdict would have been thrown out right then and there on the basis of what was known about the manipulation of evidence and so forth, shell casings and such. You know, they would have gone back to trial and probably you'd have had a different outcome.
There have been multiple appeals, though.
In this case, he stays in prison rather than tarnish the reputation of the FBI.
So, yeah. So, I mean, does this... The fact that the FBI, it's in their own interests. I mean, regardless of considerations of justice, it's in their interests to keep Leonard Peltier behind bars until he dies, essentially.
Oh, very much in their interest, but it's a broader interest that's served by that, too. And in a way, their interest is served by it being known that he was flat-out railroaded, falsely convicted, that they orchestrated this as a consequence for basically standing on his rights and not equivocating. And the message is, if you do that, if you make yourself aware of your rights and you refuse to relinquish them when you're instructed to do so, there are consequences. Here's the consequences. Okay? If you don't want to end up like Leonard Peltier, do what you're told.
Now,
and the more it's obvious that he is framed, railroaded into this position and sitting in a cage as a result of his political attitude, you know, the better it is from their point of view in conveying that message. And the only way to counter that message, of course, would be to get him out. Well, actually, rephrase that, it would have been, haven't been able to get him out earlier. Say in the mid-1980s when the court determined that it was a bogus case, but left him in prison anyway.
So would you say
the Supreme Court, incidentally, refused twice on two separate appeals. Found reversible error 13 times in the initial appeal, but failed to reverse. U.S. Supreme Court declined to review the matter and let that stand. And then you have this, where the court itself is saying the FBI, the record is fraught with FBI misconduct. And we have, it was a Bagley decision. We had two different standards for reversing cases in two different appellate courts. that's exactly the sort of thing the Supreme Court is supposed to resolve when you've got conflicting standards between federal districts. Mm-hmm. They declined that one, too. So.
Yes, and as well, President Clinton went back on a promise to have him released, presumably.
Well, Clinton went back on a promise to have him released. Clinton's Clinton.
Yeah.
You know, he's purely an opportunist, but he was basically informed by the FBI, you can do this. We can't stop you. Okay, but if you do, you'll be under FBI investigation on stuff like Whitewater and so on for the rest of your life. Or you can not do it, and we'll just basically leave you alone.
We've seen kind of a whispers of resistance in the form of Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter, and I'm wondering what lessons can be learned that might feed into a vibrant resistance. How can we avoid what's happened to the Black Panthers and the American Indian movement moving forward?
Well, consciousness is the first thing, and I've been working on that all my adult life. I mean, I was personal friends with Mark Clark, who was one of the, I mentioned it earlier, the Hampton Clark assassinations in Chicago in 69. So I've been working on this with a personal interest of that sort ever since. Being aware of it and how it works and why it works that way is the first thing. Know your enemy, I suppose. Have an actual understanding of the structural realities we're up against. So rather than just having this gut reaction to this isn't fair, this isn't right, this is wrong, we need to change it, have some real concrete understanding of what it is you're trying to change and consequently how it would need to be changed, where you're going, and so on. Okay, you mentioned two recent phenomena, one of which I find very encouraging, the other of which not so much. And then the not so much end was Occupy, because deliberately vacuous nature of analysis. Not that they're wrong about the 1%, although I would extend it a little further than 1%. Framing it 1 versus 99 as a good rhetorical flourish in an initial level, but you can't seriously argue if you're going to do organizing in more oppressed communities that they're in the same boat as some guy who's only making about $1.5 million a year, okay, because he's not a member of the 1%. He's part of the 99%. And they actually had this really stupid, in my view, sort of rule in this rule-free organization that you really couldn't highlight the conditions in any given community versus any other, because that would be divisive. Well, that actually was divisive, that vacuous sort of premise that you can't talk about specific Indian issues of the sort that we've been talking about, because that would divide them away from the settler population that might feel bad. It was kind of maybe in a superficial sort of way heartening to see large numbers of people coming out in opposition, but it was going to go nowhere. It was going to go nowhere based upon what I was saying. That's my take on that. Black Lives Matter is much more promising, but they got to get beyond, well, several things, and we'll say they might, but one, in the context of what we're talking about today, you know, blacks are actually not the most frequently, young black men actually, or not, but most frequently killed by police. American Indians are. Blacks tend to get killed by cops with dash cameras and stuff in urban areas where there's more of a possibility there's going to be media exposure on it. Indians tend to get killed more often in rural areas by somebody whose department doesn't really concern itself with things like dash cams and so forth because there's no pressure. And so it goes. But proportionately, the rate is higher for Indians than it is for blacks. And I'm not making an argument as to who's the most oppressed. Well, I am making an argument that that's worth consideration. That it ought to at least be mentioned and taken into the calculus. But we always talk about, quote, minorities mm-hmm. as being black and brown, and sometimes they include Asians. Indians aren't even on the list.
Yeah.
That may be a little different in Canada, depending on what part of Canada you're in particularly. But that's the reality down here, and that consciousness has to change for the movement to be successful. Otherwise, you get so-called liberation of various oppressed communities, all predicated upon ongoing colonization and oppression of American Indians, and that's just colonialism continued. Change forms someone.
Well,
and I'm not especially interested in talking about a better or worse form of colonialism. As far as I'm concerned, colonialism and oppression are colonialism and oppression, and it doesn't really matter who's administering that.
Okay. Well, Ward Churchill, I've really appreciated this conversation. I know we've touched on some very important realities facing the people of all different persuasions, all different colors, and I want to thank you for sharing those insights with us.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's my pleasure.
Okay.
Or not, but it was my privilege, I suppose.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Take care.
On January 10th, an MRI confirmed that Leonard Peltier suffered from abdominal aortic aneurysm, placing his life in jeopardy. The International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee is urging supporters to contact the Federal Bureau of Prisons to demand timely treatment for Peltier as well as a transfer to a suitable medical facility. The ILPDC is also renewing the call for presidential clemency by President Barack Obama so that Peltier can spend the rest of his remaining years as a free man. For details, visit www.whoisleonardpeltier.info. That concludes this week's edition of the Global Research News Hour. Next week will be a special fundraiser for the Global Research News Hour's host radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. The fundraiser will be a live broadcast starting Friday, February 12th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, which can be streamed at ckuw.ca. Regular listeners are encouraged to donate to our station by visiting www.ckuw.ca/donate and pledging at any level. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to our partners across Canada and the United States, as well as to the website globalresearch.ca and the Progressive Radio Network, which podcast our shows. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Thanks again for joining us.